You guys ready to get started?
Yeah, we are.
Okay. All right. Okay, we're on. All right. Good morning, everyone. A beautiful sunny day. My name is Pat Ward. I'm an administrative law judge. Pursuant to temporary appointment, I've been designated by the Office of Administrative Hearings at the request of the Public Service Commission to serve as a procedural hearing officer for this hearing. This is a hearing on the application of Hess North Dakota Pipeline for a certificate of site compatibility and route permit in McKenzie County, North Dakota, known as the Keene Oil Gathering System Conversion Project. This North Dakota Public Service Commission case number PU-18-24. The record will show that it is a little past 9 a.m. Central Daylight Time, April 10th, 2018. We're at Teddy's Residential Suites, Watford City, North Dakota, which is the time, date, and place set by the notice of filing and notice of hearing issued by the Public Service Commission on February 14, 2018. On January 18, 2018, Hess filed its application for a certificate of corridor compatibility and route permit to authorize conversion of a 19-mile-long, 10-inch and 16-inch diameter crude oil gathering pipeline to a transmission crude oil pipeline capable of transporting up to 160,000 barrels per day. The issues for today's hearing with regard to this application are, one, will the location, construction, and operation of the proposed facilities produce minimal adverse effects on the environment and upon the welfare of the citizens of North Dakota? Two, are the proposed facilities compatible with the environmental preservation and the efficient use of resources? And three, will the proposed facility locations minimize adverse human and environmental impact while ensuring continuing system reliability and integrity, and ensuring that energy needs are met and fulfilled in an orderly and timely fashion? Mr. Mann, would you please state your appearance for the record and the appearance of anyone else at council table?
Thank you, Your Honor. Wade Mann, Crowley Fleck, P.O. Box 2798, Bismarck, North Dakota, appearing on behalf of Hess North Dakota Pipelines, LLC, and Hess North Dakota Export Logistics, LLC. Present with me at council table is Casey Fury with Crowley Fleck.
Okay, Mr. Armstrong.
Thank you. Mitch Armstrong, Special Assistant Attorney General on behalf of the Public Service Commission. With me is Patrick Fund, the Director of the Public Utilities Division. I move that Mr. Fund be allowed to ask questions today.
Any objection, Mr. Mann? Mr. Fund will be permitted to ask questions today. If there's anyone present other than witnesses for Hess or for the commission who will or may plan to testify today or comment concerning this matter, please let me know. If you plan to do so, we'll do that upon the completion of Hess's presentation. I encourage you to take that opportunity to tell the commissioners anything you think the commission should know about this matter and to offer any information you may have for the commission's decision. I assure you that what you have to say is important to the commission and will be considered by the commission. If you do have any questions, if you intend to testify, if you let me know during one of the breaks, we're going to go with the company's presentation first, then the commission's presentation. That'll take a little time. We'll probably have at least one break. At that point, if you want to let me know, and I'll ask again at the end of the presentation for a show of hands and give anyone who wants to speak an opportunity to do so on the record so that that can be part of the commission's record when they come to consideration of this case. Council, is there any exhibits that you want to pre-offer that have been marked?
Yes, Your Honor. Hess has 12 exhibits, and I've got an exhibit list that I've provided, I believe you have. Spoken with Mr. Armstrong, and if granted, we'd like to propose that those be stipulated for admission up front.
Okay, any objection, Mr. Armstrong?
No objection.
Okay, so exhibits 1 through 12 will be received. Opening comments from counsel, Mr. Mann.
Your Honor, I don't have any comments other than I'll have four witnesses that I intend to call to testify today. Benji Foss, the first witness, project manager, testify to the project, the existing line, any new construction. Katie Schmidt with E3, the environmental consultant. She will be the second witness. Dale Weathersby will be testifying as to operational testimony with respect to the line, inspections, those types of things. And Ben Medallion will be testifying as to emergency response and incident response.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Armstrong, opening remarks?
None, Your Honor.
Commissioners, opening comments. Chair Chrisman.
Well, I would just say that we appreciate everybody being here this morning. For those that are here that are not with the company or haven't participated in our hearings before, I know it can seem maybe frustrating, especially if you got cows at home that need watching or something like that. The fact that we set a hearing for 9 o'clock and then don't let you talk first so you can get on the road. But the fact of the matter is this is the only way it works well, because we come out here because we want to hear from you and get the information from local people, local government agencies, etc. But having you respond to what you heard at the coffee shop doesn't really help us very much for the case. And so we need to have the company go first, lay out the plan, and then you can respond to the actual plan that the company is proposing. And so that's why we do it the way we do, and it takes a few hours sometimes for them to go through the information, but it will make your testimony and your information all the more valuable to us. I also would want to emphasize that here at the hearing is the only time when we can take that information from you. We aren't allowed to visit with you about the case during a break, or have you call later and tell us your information. We need it on the record while the company is here to respond to it. So we appreciate everyone being here, and if you have testimony, we hope you'll be patient. And when the time comes, give us the information we need, because my goal isn't to make sure that this project happens or to stop it from happening. My goal is to follow the law and the administrative rules of the state, and I think we can best do that when we have as much information as possible.
Thank you. Commissioner Fedorchak.
Good morning, everyone. Apologies in advance for my cold that I seem to have picked up over the weekend, unfortunately. So if I'm coughing and sneezing and sounding grovelly, that's the problem. otherwise, great to be here this morning in Wofford City. It's a beautiful day, beautiful spring day. It feels a little bit like we might be able to contemplate spring here when it's this nice out here, in the morning. The case today is a conversion pipeline, and those cases are always a little bit interesting, a little bit more delicate, I'd say, because the pipe is already in the ground. And so our review takes a little bit different focus. The impact of cultural resources and environmental resources is kind of different because the line is already constructed. So we talk a lot about the reclamation problems from the initial construction, and also emergency response, and then also waivers for landowners that are within 500 feet. That's the big difference between a gathering line and a transmission line. So we'll focus in on some of those issues and hopefully have a good discussion. Hopefully the landowners that are impacted by this line are on board with the conversion. And, you know, this line goes through a pretty delicate and sensitive part of the state, so it makes a lot of sense in many regards to make maximum use of it. And now if the company feels that this line can be better used as a transmission line, then that's, you know, it's better than going through that same area and building a new line. The environmental impact would be a lot higher. So we just want to make sure that in that process of conversion, everything's done appropriately and there aren't any things missed or things that maybe need to be addressed and fixed moving forward. So that'll be our focus today. Thanks for being here. Look forward to a productive discussion, and I look forward to hearing from you.
Commissioner Crocius.
Well, good morning, everyone. And I'm going to echo Commissioner Fedorchak's thoughts. Spring must soon be here because this has been going on for a long time. But, no, thank you for being here. We've been making quite a number of trips back and forth to the Wofford City area, and those trips are all related to new infrastructure projects that continue to be put in place, proposed, and built. And it is important that they follow the rule of law and that we're doing it correctly, because if not, everything slows down. It can compromise confidence, the public's confidence in a particular project, and it can have a significant impact, a negative impact to landowners. So ultimately, this is about asking a lot of questions about what's being done correctly. But when that happens, the positive, it becomes more economical to move crude oil in this part of the world. This is a crude oil pipeline. It takes trucks off roadways, and there are positive benefits to that without question, because that all has an impact on safety of the public. Those same roadways are being used by students going to and from school in the morning, families going to and from church, individuals commuting. So it's important, but again, it really has to be done right. I look forward to hearing from the company, from any members of the public as well, and answering some questions that I have as we go through the process. So thank you for being here.
Thank you, Commissioners. Mr. Mann, you can call your first witness.
First witness is Benji Foss.
Mr. Foss, how do you spell your first name?
Benjie
and Foss?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Before you testify, I'm required by law to advise you of the penalty regarding perjury in the state. Perjury is a false statement under oath of a material fact made by a person who knows or does not believe the statement to be true at the time it is made. Perjury is a Class C felony. A Class C felony is subject to maximum penalty of 5 years in prison, a fine of $10,000, or both may be imposed. Having been advised of this penalty, please raise your right hand so I can administer the oath. Do you promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
Sir.
Thank you. Mr. Mann.
Benji, can I have you state your name for the record and give us your business address?
Benji Foss, 10384 68th Street, Northwest, Tioga, North Dakota, 58852.
And what is your position with Hess?
Pipeline project manager.
And can you briefly describe your education, experience, and your duties and responsibilities with Hess?
Sure. I have a Bachelor of Science degree in civil engineering, registered as a professional engineer in the state of North Dakota, 10 years of experience in the oil and gas industry, with 7 of those in midstream projects.
And can you provide us with a brief description of the project?
Sure. It's a conversion of approximately 19 miles of existing oil gathering line, converting that to a oil transmission line. The project itself, the pipeline itself, starts at the northern end at the Hawkeye Oil Facility and moves south to the Crestwood Facility and then over to the DAPL Terminal. Future projects that would be associated with this would include the installation of 3 booster pump facilities, or 3 booster pump locations.
And can you briefly describe the existing gathering lines?
Sure. The portion of pipeline from the Hawkeye Oil Facility down to just north of Crestwood is a 10-inch carbon steel pipeline constructed in multiple phases. The initial phase was construction in 2014. The second section of the pipeline is from the Crestwood facility over to the DAPL terminal. It's a 16-inch carbon steel line constructed by Crestwood in 2016-2017, transfer ownership to Hess in 2017.
Okay. And could you briefly explain the need for the conversion of the line?
This conversion will provide the optionality to access oil markets on the north and south side of the Missouri River. This would allow us to access both rail terminal and pipeline markets from the Hawkeye Oil Facility.
Okay. And can you briefly describe the infrastructure that will be needed for the conversion?
Sure. Those 3 future projects that I mentioned earlier are the 3 booster pump projects, starting on the north end, would be at the Hawkeye Oil Facility. It includes the installation of a booster pump skid on an existing facility and above ground piping modifications on that facility. The second project to the south would be at the Midway location, where it's a greenfield project where we will be doing some site grading and installation of a booster pump skid there with mechanical and electrical tie-ins. And the third project would be at the existing B.B. Olson facility, where we would have a similar scope to the Midway, installation of booster pump and tie-ins.
And what is the status of the right-of-way for the project?
Since this is an existing pipeline, the right-of-way has been secured for that, obviously. The only outstanding right-of-way or land issue would be at the Midway location, where we're actively engaged with the landowner to secure that property.
And what is the corridor width that Hess is requesting to be approved for the proposed project?
250 feet.
Okay. And do you have an anticipated construction start date?
The Midway project is the first project, I guess, that we're planning to construct. Right now, that project is likely going to start in 2019. There is the possibility that we could pull some of that scope into 2018, would be kind of the civil grading portion of that, but the majority of the work would be in 2019.
Okay. So any anticipated in-service date, is that dependent upon construction?
Yeah, it'll be dependent upon start of construction, but as of right now, we're looking at Q4 of 2019 for the Midway booster pump.
Sure. And what is the estimated cost of the project?
$107 million, and this would include existing infrastructure in place as well as the future projects.
And can you briefly describe your construction practices and how surface impacts were minimized when the line was initially put in?
For the pipeline portion, boring was performed at road crossings and wetlands and other structures that we needed to avoid. Another action or practice that we perform at Hess is double ditching, where we do segregate the topsoil from the subsoil when performing trenching activities. Erosion control maintained throughout construction, and then upon completion of the project, there is a construction or a follow-up to review the right-of-way to ensure that our reclamation is appropriately taken. Seeding has taken and weeds have been taken care of.
Sure. And with respect to the new construction with the booster pumps, can you describe the extent, if any, of any surface impacts that are anticipated?
Sure. As I mentioned, the two of the booster pumps will be installed on existing facilities. The one will be at Midway. That will require a new additional surface impacts, and that will be approximately 1 acre for the pad and road to access that pad.
And do you need any permits from McKenzie County for that?
For that project, we have reached out to McKenzie County to explore what permits are required. We have not applied for any permits at this point.
Okay. And will Hess utilize one call system during its construction?
Yes.
And has Hess filed a certification related to order provisions for this project?
Yes.
Okay. And will the project be constructed in compliance with applicable safety laws and standards?
Yes. So some of those standards that were obviously OSHA for construction safety practices. This is a PHMSA line, so following PHMSA requirements, as well as code requirements of API and ASME.
And how about when the original line was put in place? Was that inspected by PHMSA?
Yes, that's correct. PHMSA inspectors were present on site for inspections of the portions of the line.
Okay. And can you just briefly highlight some of the technologies that have been used or will be used in the pipeline construction to satisfy some of these standards?
Sure. Again, as the pipeline is existing, no new technologies obviously applied here, but things we do employ a third-party inspection to ensure compliance with code specifications and drawings. 8-hour hydro test was performed on this. 100% X-ray was also performed on the pipeline during installation.
I have no further questions for Mr. Foss.
Mr. Armstrong.
Thank you. Mr. Foss, being the first witness, I'll probably ask you some questions that may or may not be appropriate for you, so if they're appropriate for a later witness, just let me know, okay?
Okay, sounds good.
So how is this pipeline is presently operating as a gathering line, is that correct?
sir.
And where does the oil go, or how does it work as a gathering pipeline?
Sure. So currently, the oil is flowing from Hawkeye Oil south into two markets, one being at, excluding Hawkeye Oil facility right now. That facility is disconnected from the gathering system. So the laterals that are gathered into this trunk line flow south to Tesoro and or Dapple.
Just to
clarify as well, the Hawkeye Oil facility is operating in a way that in which the flow is coming in, the trucks are coming into that facility, and it's flowing north across the river to our north of the river facilities.
And how will Hawkeye Oil facility be used if it's converted to a transmission pipe?
Again, this would provide us the flexibility to truck into Hawkeye Oil facility, connect Hawkeye Oil facility to the gathering system, and we could either flow that trucked oil and pipeline oil all south to Dapple, or we can also flow this potentially north to our north of the river facilities or where our rail market is.
So will the Hawkeye facility will be connected to this pipeline?
That's correct.
And is that part of the booster pump process, or is that separate?
So right now the pipeline comes into the facility. It's not physically connected. Yeah.
Okay.
On surface.
And the application talked about other alternatives, and I'm going to kind of summarize what my understanding was that Hess was trying to seek another pipeline going under Lake Sakakawea, but determined this was a more reasonable alternative. Is that right? Could you explain that to me a little more?
Yeah, I guess I can't speak specifically to that project. I'm not involved in that project. Ideally, we do want the functionality to go north or south on either side of the Missouri River.
And so with this pipeline, then, it allows the entire gathering system to flow to the Dapple pipeline?
That's correct.
And is there any other spot along the line where the oil will be shipped off to market, or does it all go to the Dapple pipeline?
On this gathering system specifically, there is an outlet point near the Midway station where we can go to Tesoro as well, which has been historically where the pipe or where the flow has gone.
And so this has been the first stage from Hawkeye to Crestwood was constructed in 2014, you said?
Three phases of the project. The initial phase in 2014, the project started at the Midway facility and extended north up near Hawkeye Oil facility. 2015, the project went from the Midway station south down to there's several laterals down there, but really the southern end would be the B.B. Olson facility. And then the third phase was in 2017 where there was a short project to extend the pipeline from the B.B. Olson facility down to north of the Crestwood facility.
And I think you said that third phase was that constructed by Crestwood?
I'm sorry. So there was three phases along the 10-inch gathering line, and then there's the Crestwood to Dapple, the 16-inch portion of that. So I guess technically there's kind of four phases of the construction on the existing line.
And Hess purchased that fourth stage from Crestwood?
Yes, sir.
Has the entire pipeline been operating as a gathering system since construction of each phase?
Yes, sir.
And so to convert it, what's needed is basically the three booster pumps.
That's correct.
What was done during construction to avoid or mitigate impacts to cultural resources?
Unfortunately, I've only been in this position of pipeline project manager for less than a year, so I was not around to see the full construction of that pipeline, so I can't speak directly to that.
You know if there's anybody testifying today who can?
Don't believe so.
I suppose that same would be true about monitoring.
Mitch, sorry to interrupt. I think Dale Weathersby may be able to address some of those issues, the initial construction.
I will direct those questions to him. But either way, Mr. Mann did ask you about the company has agreed to the certification provisions that are fairly that are typical of the Public Service Commission and agrees to follow those, even though the pipeline's already constructed.
Sure, yes.
And that would include
to the extent we may not have somebody here today investigating, you know, what trees and shrubs were removed and taking the measures required to minimize those impacts.
Okay.
Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
We do have a letter that is Exhibit 6 from the Geological Survey that talks about there being some landslide areas nearby. Are you familiar with that letter?
I'm not, no, sir.
So that would be for a different witness?
Yeah. Thank you.
Are you familiar with the landowner waiver process associated with this pipeline?
Somewhat.
We have in the exhibit three landowner waivers. The application discussed potentially six occupied structures within 500 feet of the pipeline. Could you explain to me the process for remaining waivers and how many more are needed?
I think I'll defer that to one of the other witnesses. I'm not sure who that would be.
Mr. Armstrong, probably Katie Schmidt.
As I understand your testimony, the corridor certificate the company is seeking is 250 feet centered on the pipeline route. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
May I understood you to say that wetlands and roadways were bored under?
There were bores performed.
Turn over to Mr. Fun.
Mr. Fun.
Good morning. Would you be the witness to describe any system monitoring, pipeline monitoring systems?
No, I believe that would be Mr. Weathersby.
Okay. You mentioned that PHMSA Pipeline Hazardous Material Safety Administration had been out and done an inspection or.
They were on
construction
during construction. They were on site for phases of the construction.
Typically, gathering systems aren't jurisdictional to PHMSA, so I was wondering why they did come out.
So this is a 10-inch oil line, which I guess Dale will have to clarify, but I believe that will trigger a jurisdictional of PHMSA.
I had a couple questions on page 3 of the application. Just to clarify, the specifications on the pipeline. It talks about the 16-inch and the 10-inch pipelines. When you get into the operating pressures, it talks about a maximum operating pressure of 1,480 PSI gauge. Is that for both of the pipelines?
I believe so, yes.
And then on the maximum throughput, would that be, it seems like that would be different for each pipeline.
Yes.
You know what the maximum throughput would be for. This is 160,000 barrels per day is listed for the maximum throughput, but I'm not sure if that's is that the 10-inch or the 16-inch.
Sure, that number was not hydraulically constrained. It was more constrained from marketing perspective or commercial perspective to the Apple.
Okay. So do you know what the maximum throughput is for these?
I don't know hydraulically what that maximum throughput would be, no.
Okay. Can that be provided?
We can get that and submit it as a late filed exhibit.
A couple of the things that we typically put in our order. I was wondering, I don't know if you would be the right witness to say, yes, the company will do this, or another witness, but One of the things we usually ask is that if a spill by the system requires notification to any other state or federal agency, HESS would also inform the commission of the spill within 24 hours of occurrence by leaving a message at the commission's toll-free number, followed up with an email. Is that something the commission, the company would do?
I think Mr. Badalla could speak to that.
Okay. I guess one of my other questions was whether PHMSA had been notified of the conversion yet, or have they?
I'm not aware.
Okay. Typically, we'll say that no order will say 30 days prior to operating as a transmission line unit inform PHMSA.
Okay. Okay.
And I think you said it, but was the existing pipeline constructed in accordance with PHMSA regulations, Part 195?
Yes, sir.
What is the commission often requires a greater depth of cover for the pipeline than the PHMSA Part 195. Do you know what the depth of cover is for the pipeline?
I do not know. Typically, HESS requires 5 foot of cover to top of pipe on our pipeline projects. You can follow up with that.
Well, I think that would be good as a late file exhibit. Okay. That is all I have. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, questions from the commissioners. Commissioner Fedorchak.
Good morning. I'd like to just go back to some of the questions that Mr. Armstrong was asking on how this line is functioning and sort of the big picture for your system here. You mentioned earlier that the gas or the oil, excuse me, is going to the north side the lake today. How is that happening?
So originally the way the system was intended was that the Keene oil gathering gather all of oil in the Keene area, flow that north to Hawkeye Oil Facility, and then from that point Hawkeye Oil Facility would have shipped it north to our north of the river facilities, primarily to our rail terminal, which was kind of where we were trying to export most of our oil at the time. This would be in 2014-ish.
Mm-hmm.
About that same time, with the change in market, the desire was to move more oil to pipeline. DAPL came into play as an option, and that flow north to Hawkeye Oil never came to fruition, I guess. So at that point, the oil from the Keene oil gathering system was basically flowing south from, you know, from the north portion of the project, and flowing north from the south portion of the project and going into Tesoro at that midway point. And that's how we were getting our flow to market. Recently, with DAPL coming available south of the river, we've reduced our flow to Tesoro and increased the flow to DAPL. So basically the system is now flowing in that direction currently.
Okay. And does HESS have a way to transport the oil from the Hawkeye facility north to the other side of the river currently?
We do, currently, yes.
And how? What is that?
So that is via existing river crossing.
Pipeline?
Yes.
Okay.
And that is trucked oil that's coming into that facility and flowing north through that pipeline.
Okay. So a number of years ago, we had a fairly extensive review process of a plan that has had to convert some of those lines, and I think it was going to be oil and gas and use those to access the north side. And it's been a couple years, so am I to understand that there was an existing oil that you're still using?
Yes, ma'am.
The conversions that were contemplated then have not taken place, additional conversions?
Yes, I was not directly involved in that project, but there are three lines, an NGL, high-pressure gas, and oil line that are crossing the river, yes.
And operational today, all three of those in that manner, or what?
I don't know about the NGL and gas, but the oil line is in service.
Okay. And what's the capacity of that line?
I don't know that number.
Okay. So currently, the gathering system, the north part of this line that goes from the Hawkeye oil facility, how does the oil get into that line? Tell me again.
Excuse me, what was it?
The furthest north point of this system that starts at the Hawkeye oil facility and goes south to Midway.
Sure.
How is that line fed?
It is. It's fed through laterals. It's connected to the Hawkeye oil facility, but not flowing. I mean, it's isolated from the Hawkeye oil facility, so that flow is not getting in. It's coming in from laterals from the field into the trunk line from regular production facilities.
And so when you say it's connected, help me understand what that looks like, connection at the
Hawkeye. There's a riser at the edge of the pad or on the facility somewhere.
Okay.
Again, for the Hawkeye oil scope, it's installation of the booster pump and above ground piping modifications to be able to connect that in.
Okay. The application contemplates starting construction later in second quarter of this year and operational perhaps 4 months later, or wasn't real definitive on when it would be operational. And you mentioned delaying construction until 2019, second quarter 2019, so a full year. Can you speak to that? What changed?
Yeah, it really is the demand as far as meeting current production and forecasting out to when the facility is actually needed to meet our expected future production. So I guess basically it was pushed out because of hydraulic capacity we have right now. We feel like we can make it, you know, an extra however many months, right, until we actually need the facility. So this new date aligns more with when our actual production forecasts.
Okay. Can somebody speak to the sound levels of the booster pumps, and would that be you, or do you have a witness?
We probably don't have a witness today that can speak to this, to the actual sound levels. Yeah, I guess I wouldn't be able to speak to it. We are still in the design phase of those booster pumps,
okay.
I guess, so.
If that's something that the company can respond to, I believe in the certification we have some sound. Do we, Pat, have in the pipeline certification sound parameters?
I don't think so. I think that would come in the,
I think we,
in the order.
Okay.
The other thing to, you know, to have along with the location of the pumps would be, and the sound levels from the pumps would be, the nearest
residents.
Okay.
Yeah, that would be helpful.
Sound receptors.
Not very often, but it has happened in the past where the pumps that aren't, depending on how big they are and how loud they are, if they aren't enclosed, they have caused some landowner complaints, nearby residences complaining. So just if we can talk through that a little bit, that would be helpful. Just want to make sure. I think I've got all the questions for you covered, but we talked Mitch asked about the impacts or what was done during construction to minimize the impacts to cultural resources and environmental resources. And remind me who's going to address that. There is a later witness that can address that, or you guys can provide some late filed information on that issue.
I think Dale Weathersby can address some of those, what was done with the initial construction.
Okay, very good. I think that's it for now. Thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioner Crocious, do you want to go next?
Yes, that's fine. Thank you. Now, you're the pipeline project manager, is that correct?
Currently, yes, sir.
Okay. And how long have you?
Less than a year in this position.
Okay. So just so I know, from a questioning standpoint, do the following people that will be coming up and testifying, do they work for you, or are you just, I shouldn't say just, but you concentrate on the engineering portion of it, the construction portion itself?
Yes, sir. New pipeline installs. Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. Can you tell me about the shutoff valves, locations of shutoff valves along the 19-mile pipeline route?
Yeah, I guess I'm not familiar with the shutoff. I think that could be possibly covered in the operational portion of the questioning.
Okay. Would that be part of the engineering and the design of the pipeline?
Yes, sir. I guess since I wasn't directly involved in the actual installation and construction of this specific pipeline, I'm a little gray on the actual system itself.
Okay, well, just so I can condense this a little bit more, I'm not trying to be difficult. I'm just trying to get my arms around it. So, and it's only my second cup of coffee today. So by the third one, it'll be really clear to me. But, okay, so, you know, just to really, really, so I understand, are you essentially in charge with just the upgrades to the pipeline? What's in the ground is in the ground. Somebody else did that. You're just tasked with the booster pumps and some other components. Would that be accurate? Or
yes, sir. I'm familiar with most of the surface facility projects that we're proposing. Not as familiar with the existing infrastructure that's in place. And then also I'm involved with any future pipelines that we would install, but you know, nothing specific to this project.
I'll defer to Commissioner Chrisman. I need to,
Commissioner Chrisman,
change my order up a little.
What's the distance from the Hawkeye facility to Crestwood?
That is approximately 15 miles.
And then, so Crestwood to DAPO is 4.
Yeah.
So I thought I understood something, and now as I listen to you, now I'm less certain.
Okay.
I thought that the Hawkeye to Crestwood section had a bunch of laterals coming into it, and that's what I still continue to understand.
Correct.
And that you had the option of flowing that either into the Crestwood storage facility or into the Hawkeye storage facility.
No, sir. two contributors into the system.
The current system I'm talking about,
sure.
Not your plans.
Yeah, so Crestwood flows into the system and Hess flows into the system. Outlets are to DAPL or to Sorrel.
The lateral lines come into this 15-mile stretch.
Yes, sir.
Do they all go down to Crestwood?
They don't go to Crestwood. Crestwood comes into the system. as production comes south from the various laterals through the 10-inch, and Crestwood comes in, and then the option to go over to DAPL into their terminal, or to go north, if DAPL is not available, to go north and go into Tesoro as another outlet. So there's two inlets, Hess and Crestwood. There's two outlets, Tesoro and DAPL.
If this is approved, when you get it done, does the oil not then go from the north part through Crestwood and down the last 4 miles and into DAPL?
It does. Crestwood and Hess production commingle just north of Crestwood and flow over to DAPL. If this was approved, we would add the Hawkeye oil facility into the Hawkeye oil facility flow into the mix, which would basically go down the 10-inch, and Crestwood would continue to come in, and we would flow over to DAPL with the addition of the booster pumps along the pipeline route.
So the booster pump that you propose to build at Hawkeye, what's between that and Hawkeye right now? The last just few feet.
Right now, the surface piping at Hawkeye Oil Facility would not allow that connection into the oil gathering system. It's only piped to flow north to our north of the river facilities.
So oil from those laterals can go currently north into the Hawkeye facility?
No, sir.
Then why is the pipe built into there?
Again, the intent was that we were going to flow everything up through Hawkeye Oil Facility and flow it north to our north of the river facilities. That never developed or never.
You never materialized that plan because the outflow out of Hawkeye to go north never was able to be expanded.
Well, and we did get the outflow out of Hawkeye going north, yes.
Okay. And you said Katie is the one to talk to about landowner waivers and...
Yes, sir.
That sort of thing. Did you say the estimated cost of the project, including the existing infrastructure, was $107 million?
Yes, sir.
What's the separation as to the existing infrastructure as opposed to what you propose to build?
I would say the majority of that is sunk into existing infrastructure. I don't know the cost estimates right now on the three booster pump projects.
Can you get that and turn it in? Your Honor, I think I'm done. That's it for after I look at the map a second time. Maybe I'll have some more questions, but I think I understand it now.
I'm wondering if we should just have Mr. Mann call as the next witness now, and we can always bring
more.
This witness back if we need to.
Follow up too.
You do? Okay, then. All right. We'll start with you then, Mr. Mann. Do you have any follow up at this point?
I do not, Your Honor.
Mr. Armstrong.
Okay. I apologize for this, and we've gone over it a couple times, but I'm still a little confused, and I hope. I do hope I'm the only one, but. And maybe it's part of the way everybody asks questions a little differently, but I'm still confused when, if this is converted to a transmission pipeline, Hawkeye oil will then be allowed to flow south through the pipeline. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And presently, as a gathering system, it cannot do that.
That's correct, sir.
Okay, so if it's converted, will the Hawkeye still continue oil continue to flow north, or will that be solely south?
Again, I believe we want the optionality to flow north to our rail terminal or south to DAPL, again, depending upon markets.
But that actual north and south line won't connect together, but the Hawkeye facility will be kind of the meeting point, if you will.
Yes, sir.
And then the other oil that will enter into, that it already is as a gathering line, are the lateral lines that go from the Hawkeye to the Crestwood facility.
Yes, the trunk line goes from Hawkeye to the Crestwood facility, and there's several laterals that are feeding this trunk line with production facilities out on those.
That lateral production, I think what I'm really getting at is this conversion line itself, if approved, will flow south. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay, so everything of those lateral lines will flow south towards Crestwood and either to Soar or to Apple.
Yes, sir.
Okay, I understand now. And then I had one question for you on a map. If you can go to Appendix B. It would be map H7 of 17. This is where the Midway booster pump is.
I'm sorry, which page was that?
Seven of 17.
All right.
So I think this deals with part of the new addition that you're primarily involved in, correct? The Midway booster pump?
Yes, sir.
And the pipe in that area, it's got a weird jog, if you will, that I don't know that I've ever seen. Could you explain why that area is like that and what's going on there?
Are you speaking to
where it
comes in and...
I guess it jogs east and then turns and then comes back west and then heads south again, right where the Midway booster pump is proposed.
Yes, sir. That's a launcher and receiver located at that location. So low north receiver, and then it jumps into a launcher to head south again.
And will those facilities remain, or does the booster pump take care of those, the need for those?
That would remain, and from these launchers and receivers, this is where we would receive our suction and discharge to the pumps.
Okay. And so all the pipe that's presently in the ground does remain the same. It's just the addition of the pumps and tying them into the pipe.
That's correct.
Thank you. That's all questions.
Okay.
Mr. Fine.
I believe you mentioned in your testimony that there was a follow-up review of the right-of-way after construction of the pipe.
Yeah.
Do you have a report that could be filed with the commission?
I don't. Usually our construction supervisors are actively reviewing the right-of-ways after the fact and meeting with landowners if necessary to discuss any issues that they have.
Do they record any of the trouble areas in the reclamation that needs to be done, like in work orders or anything?
Not typically, no.
Thank you.
Commissioner Fedorchak.
One more follow-up on the big picture system. I've got the map now. So currently I'm looking at the overview map that was provided in the application, I think, under Section 2. Is that where the maps were?
The first map in Appendix B.
Appendix, yeah. Thank you, Mitch. And so on the north end of the line, all of this is fed by laterals, and it currently flows south.
Yes, ma'am.
And after it's converted, it'll be fed by laterals and continue to flow south.
That's correct.
So what changes with the conversion?
The additional flow from Hawkeye Oil Facility.
So, which is currently fed by different system right now.
Really receiving trucked oil currently.
Trucked oil that goes there and goes north.
Currently, yes.
And the reason why you aren't operating the system north to that now is what?
We can just more easily access the pipeline market south of the river.
I see. So it makes more sense to go south from a marketing standpoint.
Yes.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Mr. Crocious.
All right. First map in Appendix B that I believe Commissioner Fedorchak I believe that is the one she had up. The project's been referred to as a 19-mile line, but when I look at the map, I believe those are mile markers. They appear to be mile markers, and it shows 18. Is that since when I look at the legend and it shows the line, where's the missing mile?
Sure.
Are those reference points? But they do look like mileage markers to me.
Yes, I agree. I don't know that. Don't know that answer.
That would be important to clarify that we don't have a missing mile somewhere in the project that we're not looking at. I assume we don't, but it's an important point. The other thing I would just say in terms of, and this is, I'm speaking for myself, but as an observation, we're asking a lot of questions that I would define as starting point questions in the project, because when I'm looking at the project, I'm looking at it as if it's not in the ground. All right? The fact that it's converting from an existing line over to a transmission line doesn't mean we don't back up and look at all the criteria just as we would with a project that isn't in the ground. So right now the questions that I've been have down are really to lay the foundation for myself as I'm making a decision and looking at the project overall. And I believe we will have a witness coming up that we can go back to and get the groundwork, initial groundwork done, so to speak, in terms of the questions that at least I would have. Is that correct?
Yeah.
I think it's just really important for the company to recognize and realize that, at least for myself, I'm viewing this as if it's not even in the ground. We can't just fast forward to the final items, and we're not just approving three booster pumps and a few other items, lingering landowner issues or right-of-way easement issues. So I won't belabor the point, I think I've made it, but just I think it's an important point for any future conversion. I think it would help speed up the process.
Additional questions, Commissioner?
Or is it?
Keep that over. Commissioner Krosius, do you have any other questions?
No, I do not.
Okay. Commissioner Christman.
I'm on this first map, and Appendix B, too. Okay. When we talk about Crestwood today, I assume that we're talking about way to the right, which in this case is the south, the aerial facility, right?
Yes, sir.
And so from there over to mile marker 15, is that the missing mile that Commissioner Crashes was potentially?
That could be.
And now, through the last round of questioning, I understood why you were hooked into Hawkeye and what your intention was when you did that and how that's not working out and what happens here. But now I need to understand better how the existing system is working into the Crestwood facility.
Again, it's Crestwood's gathering system that is feeding into this. So picture off page, their gathering system is coming through this aero facility and flowing up into mile point 15. And at mile point 15 is where Hess and Crestwood's flow commingle and flows over to DAPL.
Okay, and the first booster station is back up at Hawkeye, the midway is in the middle. Where's the last booster station? Is that the one at about mile marker between 13 and 13.5?
Yes, sir.
It's the third booster station.
Yes, sir.
What's there already because you don't need new right-of-way?
That's an existing production facility. There's also a launcher and receiver located at that location, similar to the Midway location.
Okay. No other questions. Thank you.
Is a launcher a pump of some sort?
No, sir. It's a piping mechanism where you basically can receive pipeline pigs.
Okay.
Launcher and receiver, so you launch from one and receive in another one. Sir.
So when the oil is flowing now in one direction or another, what is it that's pushing it? Is it just the pressure from the wellheads, or how does that work?
It's production. It's lacked from the field, from the various laterals feeding.
Okay, so it's the pressure that's coming from the laterals into the line.
Yes, sir.
And is it gravity that decides which direction it goes now, or what is there just that enough pressure that comes from there to make it flow in a certain direction?
That's correct. Yes, we're relying solely on that pressure to reach the DAPL.
So this project would give you the opportunity to reverse that pressure in the sense that you could push the oil up the line the other direction if you wanted to.
Actually, it would increase the capacity of the overall line by increasing the pressure via booster pumps.
Okay, but you also talked about the option of flowing north from the northernmost point.
That's correct.
And that would be because of the pumps located along the way?
Yes.
Okay. All right, that's all I have. Anybody else have any follow-up? Okay, Mr. Armstrong.
I'm still on the same map. Where is the Tesoro line?
Oh, I'm sorry. It's near the Midway booster pump. It's just to the west, I guess, of the Midway.
Okay, so then the oil can now end, if it's converted, can flow into Tesoro at that spot as well.
In previously, we were flowing to Tesoro at that location.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Foss? It's 10:07. Let's take a little break till 10:15. Mr. Foss, you're going to be around in case we need to have you back later?
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Very good. It's 10:20. Mr. Mann, you want to call another witness?
Yes, Your Honor. I had initially intended to call Katie Schmidt next, but I think I'll call Clay Anderson just to address the cost of the booster pump facility, some of the breakdown. There's a question on that.
Okay, very good. Mr. Anderson, you're going to enlighten us on some of these things where we're unenlightened still?
I'll sure try.
Okay. You heard me read the perjury admonition this morning?
That's correct.
Okay, raise your right hand, please. You promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding? Thank you.
And Clay, can I have you state your name for the record and give us your business address?
Clay Anderson, 3015 6th Street Southwest, Suite 20, Minot, North Dakota, 58701.
And Clay, what's your position with Hess?
I'm an advisor, engineer, project lead.
Okay. And with respect to this project, what's been your role?
I'm the project lead for the Midway Boosters Pump Station.
Okay. And you've been here. You heard there was a question with respect to the cost of the project, right?
Yep, that's
and
right.
The full cost of the project was estimated at approximately $107 million. Do you know the breakdown, what the cost of the booster facility or the booster pumps will be in relation to the rest of the project?
So the Midway Booster Pump Station cost is estimated to be between $5 and $7 million.
Okay. Do you have estimates on either any of the other booster pumps that may be added?
The B.B. Olson location would probably be estimated between $7 to $9 million additional.
Okay. I have no further questions.
Okay. Mr. Armstrong, questions for Mr. Anderson?
I mean, I don't have the name right in front of you, but the other booster pump, you don't have an estimate for that one?
We currently don't have an accurate estimate. It was removed from our scope based off our hydraulic model.
What does that mean?
We decided not to go forward with the B.B. Olson location because the Midway location met our hydraulic needs at this point.
So right now, is the scope to only have two booster pumps?
The current scope right now is to install a booster pump skid at the Midway location, and in that skid, there are two pumps.
Okay. Give me one second, please. Our map, the first page of Exhibit B, has a booster pump at the Hawkeye Oil facility. Is that one still within the scope?
Within the our current scope is just to construct the midway pump today. The those additional booster pump stations along that corridor would be built as needed for required flows, required production, required volumes.
So the current, I understand from Mr. Foss's testimony, he said we're going to start with the Hawkeye in 2019, correct?
The first booster pump station that would be
in not Hawkeye, excuse me, Midway.
That's correct.
Yeah, sorry about that. And so is the plan then to see how it works with that, and then and if you need the B.B. Olson, do the B.B. Olson, then see how it goes with that, and then if you need the Hawkeye, then do the Hawkeye? Is that kind of the analysis?
That's a fair statement, yes, sir.
Happen to know if that $107 million number includes all three booster pumps or if it's just some of them?
I do not know that.
That's all the questions I have. Thank you.
Can you answer any questions about the sound levels of the pump while you're up here?
At this time, I cannot.
Okay. Mr. Fine, do you have any questions for?
No questions. Thanks.
Commissioners?
I was going to ask about the sound, but if somebody else can, or you guys can get that information to us later.
I do have a call into our pump leader to see if he can provide that information, and I will notify our rep.
Excellent. Thank you.
Commissioner Crochus?
No questions.
Commissioner Crisman?
I do not. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you.
Next witness.
Edie Schmidt.
And Ms. Schmidt, you've been here before, so you know the drill as far as the perjury admonition.
That is true.
I have you raise your right hand. You promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you.
Katie, can you state your name for the record and give us your business address?
Katie Schmidt, 871 Jefferson Avenue, St. Paul, Minnesota.
And by whom are you employed and what capacity?
E3 Environmental is the senior environmental consultant.
And can you describe your qualifications with respect to environmental projects and permitting?
Yeah, I have a Bachelor of Science degree in civil engineering with an emphasis in environmental from Iowa State University, and I have been an environmental consultant for over 12 years, primarily working with the oil and gas industry.
And were you the person primarily responsible for conducting the environmental review on this project and for preparation of the application?
Yes, I was in charge of overseeing the field survey and the preparation of the application.
And are you familiar with the natural resource and cultural resources surveys and reports for the project?
Yes, I am.
And can you identify the study and survey areas for the project?
Right. We used a study corridor, which was a one-mile corridor, which is centered upon the project alignment. We conducted our desktop analysis using that, and then we completed field surveys of the survey corridor, which was a 250-foot area centered on the current alignment.
Has a cultural resource investigation been completed for the project?
Yes, it has.
And what were the results of that investigation?
Right, so we completed a Class 1 literature search first. That investigation identified 55 previously completed surveys of the area. Those surveys identified 47 previously recorded cultural resources in our one-mile study corridor. We then went out and conducted our field surveys of the 250-foot survey corridor. During that, we attempted to relocate 6 previously recorded cultural resources. We were unable to relocate them within our 250-foot survey corridor. In addition to that effort, we did record 10 new cultural resources. 2 of those were historic farmsteads in nature. They did not overlap with our center line of our alignment itself. but they were within our 250-foot survey corridor. And eight of those 10 newly recorded sites were identified as isolates, so they were not eligible for protection under the National Resource Historic Preservation Act.
And Katie, you've been in communication with SHPO and had them review the report of your investigation, correct?
Yes, that's correct. We received concurrence from the SHPO on both our original report and our addendum report.
And are those contained within the application?
Yes, they are. They are found in Appendix C under agency correspondence as well as in Appendix E.
And the SHPO's concurrence letters are both there as well, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Has a wetland assessment been completed for the project?
Yes, we did.
And what were the results of that assessment?
Sure, we did a field survey of the 250-foot survey corridor. We identified 16 wetland features. Five of those features were associated with intermittent flowage ways, drainage ways.
Okay. Are there any exclusion areas as described in North Dakota law and regulation that will be affected by the proposed project?
We did identify the cultural resources I previously discussed. However, the project will not have any impact on those as we know the pipeline is in the ground and further ground disturbing activities will not impact those resources.
And SHPO has concurred with how you plan to address that, correct?
That's correct.
Are there any avoidance areas that are described by North Dakota law and regulation that will be affected by the proposed project?
We did identify six potentially occupied structures through the work of using the land department. They concluded or verified that five of those were actually occupied. One of them was a farm shop at an associated residence. At this time, we have obtained four landowner waivers. One of those waivers covers two of the properties because they're both owned by Crestwood, and one landowner waiver is pending but is in process. In addition to the occupied structures, the Little Missouri Grasslands does encroach within the one-mile corridor of the project but does not encroach within the 250-foot survey corridor.
Right, and then as part of your surveys, you also identified areas of instability, and you're familiar with a letter that was submitted as well. Can you just comment on that?
Yeah, we did a desktop review of publicly available information. It did identify some areas of potential geologic instability or landslide areas. Those areas are, some of them do fall within the one-mile corridor. However, they do not encroach within the 250-foot study or survey corridor.
With respect to the PSC's selection criteria, are there any adverse impacts from the project?
As I mentioned earlier, we did encounter 16 wetland features and five waterway drainageway type features. They were crossed, some of those features were crossed by the project. However, it does not appear that there were adverse impacts.
Has HESS maximized the benefits set forth in the PSC's policy criteria in developing the project?
Yes.
Are any other permits or authorizations necessary for the project?
The McKenzie County Weed Control Board was one of the agencies that received a project notification letter. Through our correspondence with them, they have asked that a weed control board be prepared and submitted to the project. That is currently underway.
And to date, have any state or federal agencies objected to the project?
Not that I'm aware of.
And Katie, in your opinion, is the project designed in such a manner that its location, construction, and operation will produce minimal adverse effects on the environment and the welfare of the citizens of North Dakota?
Yes.
And is it also your opinion that the project is compatible with the environmental preservation and efficient use of resources?
Yes.
And will the project's location minimize adverse human and environmental impact while ensuring continuing system reliability and integrity?
Yes.
And will the project's operation ensure that energy needs are met and fulfilled in an orderly and timely fashion?
That's my understanding.
Okay. I have no further questions.
Mr. Armstrong.
Schmidt, when do you happen to know when the Class 1 was done?
We did the Class 1 in advance of our initial field survey in the spring of 2016, and then a secondary Class 1 was conducted in the fall of 2017 as we went out and did some additional surveys for the Midway booster pumps.
And how about the Class 3? Do you know when that was done?
The Class 3 was done following the Class 1 in both situations. like within a month, give or take.
How about the wetlands assessment?
The wetlands assessment were done at the same time as the cultural resource work.
So at that time, anyway, at least as I understood Mr. Foss's testimony, the gathering line from Hawkeye to Crestwood would have already been completed.
Correct.
And the from Crestwood to the DAPL facility would or would not have been, was or was not complete at the time of your last one?
I do not believe it was complete. That's my understanding.
Do you happen to know what avoidance or mitigative measures were taken during the construction of the gathering lines to avoid archaeological or other cultural sites?
I do not, as we were not involved with the project at those times, but I think another witness can speak to that.
And so for that issue, I would go to, I think, Mr. Weathersby, but as far as with your cultural resource surveys and actions, all sites were either avoided, all sites were avoided, is that correct? All eligible sites were avoided.
Right. So we recorded 10 new sites, the ones that were recorded and would have required avoidance from what we understand to be the construction of the gathering line and the location of the current pipeline likely avoided those sites. As far as the sites that were previously recorded and that we were unable to re-record, I can't speak to that.
So what you found anyway, it obviously not been impacted by the pipeline.
Correct.
And then for the new construction of the proposed booster pumps, that new construction avoids all of the sites you identified.
Correct.
Okay. You also talked about the wildlife investigation. When was that done?
That was done at the same time as the wetland water body survey.
And what did you determine the impacts to wildlife would be from? So, apologize, but we're dealing with two different time periods here. So what did you determine the impact to wildlife would be for the new construction of the booster pumps?
We determined that due to the location of the project and the nature of activity in the area that there would not be an impact to wildlife.
And as far as the existing pipeline, do you have any comment or opinion on its effect or impact on wildlife?
I would say that based upon the nature of the project area being primarily agricultural and, again, just the overall activity in the area, it's unlikely that a threatened, endangered, or species were affected.
The application, I assume this comes from your report, indicates there's suitable habitat for the Rufa redknot, whooping crane, gray wolf, Dakota skipper, and north long-eared bat. Is that your recollection as well?
Potential habitat.
Potential habitat. And what? How do you determine if there's actually those species living there versus just having potential habitat?
Right. Part of it is our survey. When we were on the ground, we did not identify any habitat or encounter any species. Again, just the nature of the area and knowing that a more suitable habitat is located to the north with the lake, that it's unlikely that the project impacted anything.
The application, I'm looking at page 14, but it also says it's the Migratory Bird Treaty Consultation, and it says MBTA mitigation may be required. Are you familiar with that portion?
Correct, yes.
Could you explain that to us, please?
Yeah, so depending on the timing of future construction activities, if they were to occur during the migratory bird observed breeding window, which is typically February 15th to July 15th here in North Dakota, we would recommend perhaps that a visual bird survey be conducted before any ground disturbing activities occurred to prevent impacting any nesting or breeding birds. My understanding of the current project schedule is that any ground disturbance that will occur, say with the midway booster pump, will occur well after the breeding season has ended.
And if it does not, then those additional measures should be taken.
Correct.
You talked about the landowner waivers, and you talked about five of them.
Yes.
And the application talks about six occupied structures within 500 feet. Can you explain that, please?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we wrote the application, we used desktop and aerial imagery to try to determine if they're, you know, what looked to be an unoccupied residence. Then we rely on the land groups to verify that information and collect and actually collect the waivers from the landowners. So if you want, I can walk you through where the occupied structures are and where they're obtaining waivers for. Would that be helpful?
That would be great.
All right. If we go to Appendix B, to the aerial map set, on page 1 and 2, I apologize, you will see a orange triangle just to the north of WV-79. That is an...
Just wait 1 second for everybody.
Sorry.
Everybody else get a chance to get there.
So that is, they are obtaining a landowner waiver for that. I believe it has been obtained.
So is this the one that you're waiting on, or is
this one has been obtained?
Okay.
This waiver has been obtained. It's the same structure on map 2. I apologize, just a little run over. On page 3, you will see that there are two structures located to the west of the line. The structure on the right has been confirmed to be a farm shed, and as such is not an occupancy.
So that would be the difference between the 6 and the 5?
Correct.
Okay.
And a waiver has been obtained for the other residents on this map. The next one is on page 6. This is the landowner for which the waiver is pending. And the Hess has been in contact with them as recently as yesterday to gain that signature. And then we're going to jump back towards the end to page 14. You will see just south of the, or just west, I guess, of the aero facility, that is a occupants for which they're obtaining a waiver. Actually, it has been obtained. And the last is on page 17.
Did you say page 14 for the one just previous to page 17?
Correct.
And the one on page 17, if I understood you correctly, has been obtained as well?
That's correct.
You've got the exhibit pile in front of you to your right.
Yes.
Starting at exhibit 9 or the waiver. So exhibit 9 is the Crestwood waiver. And if I understood correctly, Crestwood is the one who owned two of those occupied structures?
That's my understanding, yes.
So if I understood you correctly, this waiver would apply to two of those structures that we just talked about?
Correct.
And then Exhibit 10 and 11 are the two additional occupied structures that you talked about having obtained a waiver for?
Correct.
And then there's a pending waiver for the occupied structure on page 6 of 17.
Correct.
And we will be asking for a late filed on that waiver upon receipt.
Have we got that landowner's name? Can we put it under?
I don't have it personally.
Okay.
I'll turn it over to Mr. Fahn while I check my notes to see if I have any other questions. Thank you.
Just have, in general, when you were doing field surveys along the route and in the corridor, any areas that, in terms of reclamation and restoration, that needed follow-up?
I'm not aware of any areas. None were identified in our survey reports, but I wasn't personally out there observing the right-of-way during field surveys. It's field specialists out doing that.
is it part of your scope to check for reclamation and restoration?
Typically, when we do natural resource surveys, that is not something we look for, but we can include that in the future if that's something that would be beneficial for these types of projects.
No further questions. Thank you.
Commissioners, Commissioner Fedorchak.
Thank you, Katie. The thanks for going through the map with all the waivers too. If I might just go back to page one.
Sure.
Is that of those maps? Page one. Is that the waiver for, or is that the property of Eldo and Darlene Johnson?
I do not have property information other than that the waiver has been obtained.
Okay. And then on the waiver for Crestwood, there's only one property listed, unless it's at there's two properties at
right.
the exact same location.
Right. I believe it's the same location with how their facility is set up.
Okay. On the cultural resources, if we look at, let's see here. There's a table. It's page 18 of section 3 in the application.
Okay.
That's where it lists all of the sites that you found and lists the six sites that were previously recorded and that you were unable to relocate. So those were previously recorded by SHPO?
Correct.
Their database?
Well, yes, previous surveys done by other companies recorded those features.
Okay. So what should we conclude happened to them?
It's hard to say. As you're aware, there's been a significant amount of development in this area, a gathering line construction, as we are aware, doesn't have the same requirements as a transmission line. Some of these sites that, you know, what they were classified as can be difficult to relocate. There was a stone circle, some rock features, a lithic scatter, so items that don't have perhaps a lot of integrity as a whole, so at times they can be dispersed. One of them was the site lead. A site lead typically can occupy an entire section, and there's one known resource within there, but the exact location isn't disclosed. In this case, it was believed to be the historic Kinsley Post Office, and it wasn't found within our survey corridor, but that doesn't mean that it's not still within that section.
I see. Okay. Regarding the wetlands, does the pipeline cross any wetlands?
It crosses 14 wetland or waterway features.
Okay. And can you speak to how those crossings were constructed?
I cannot personally speak to how they were constructed as we weren't involved at that time. I can tell you that looking at the field information and the features that they all could have been trenched across or drilled and been in compliance with 404 of the Clean Water Act. There were no Section 10 waters encountered.
Okay. What about trees and shrubs? Who can speak to that in terms of which were, how many were potentially removed or how we can quantify that? Impact?
Right. We did an inventory while we were out there. Obviously, that was post-construction of a large part of the project, so I can't speak to that. We did inventory the area that Crestwood later constructed, so perhaps we could use that data to work backwards, but I don't have any information on that specifically.
Okay. So I'm wondering. How do we deal with that?
I was going to handle it with, I believe, Mr. Weathersby, but still... to answer the question, they're still required to abide by the tree and shrub specifications. It's just a matter of getting the information and making compliance if it's approved.
Okay. Okay, and then One more question, that's the geologically unstable areas. Could you, I think I found them on the map, but according to the letter from the North Dakota Geological Survey, they say that it appears the pipeline corridor between 30th and 32nd Street and 35th and 36th Street, 2.5 miles east of Keene, travel near previously mapped land site. You stated to Mr. Armstrong that it does not. So can you just clarify that for us on the maps?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you could turn back to Appendix B again, we're going to go to the last map set, which are the topographic maps. And while we're turning the pages, a little bit of clarification on the project notification letters that we send out to agencies. We send them the proposed alignment, or in this case, the alignment of the pipeline, and then we just detail the one-mile corridor on that document. We don't put our survey corridor on there. So if you flip to page 4 of the topographic map set, I believe this is where the area they are referring to, where it says Blue Buttes, and you'll see kind of these orange cross-hatched polygons. Those are areas of landslide deposits. I believe that's the area they're discussing, and it intersects our one-mile corridor, but not the actual survey corridor, the corridor being requested here today.
In the bottom left?
Yeah, there's some on the bottom. Yeah, the bottom left, there's some up on the top, and then it goes onto page number 5 as well.
Okay. All right. I think that's it for me. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Commissioner Kroshes.
Are you aware of any landowner concerns from prior construction?
I'm not aware of any, no.
And we're waiting for a late exhibit on depth of cover. Can you speak to that at all?
I cannot.
I don't think I have any other questions. I believe they've all been answered.
Mr. Christman.
When we talk about occupied structures, I often tend to focus on them as residences.
Sure.
But just for the record, would you clarify what kinds of occupied structures we're talking about that these six could possibly be?
Right, so it expands beyond just a residence into a business or a school or any other type of occupied dwelling, I guess.
So in the cases of the Crestwood location or the Dakota Access location, those are probably more office buildings or something like that on their sites, correct?
Correct.
Okay, and then no, you didn't say this, but as I look at it, which exhibit is which? Exhibit 10, the Dakota Access release, would appear to me to be the occupied structure on page 17. Very likely.
I would agree with that.
And Exhibit 9, the Crestwood, would appear to be the one on page 14. Because it's on Crestwood.
Yes, I believe
property.
So.
And then the one on page 6 is pending, so that's not any of these that we have here. One on page 3 is a farmstead, and the one on page 1 is something. And I say the one about on page 3 because you said that the one that's not occupied is a farm shed, so I'm assuming that's a farm home. It's the other one. But so I'm having a hard time figuring out how Crestwood has two of these. One of them I get is that one on page 14, but this almost has to be that the second one is either on page 1 or page 3. I don't see how that's Crestwood's area.
Right. Let me review those waivers. I was just made aware of them yesterday. we have? I guess I'd have to get more information on that. I was told that one of the waivers applies to two properties.
So we'll have to get that clarified. And yes. And it would be nice if on these waivers, in the clarification, it indicated which page they're on. Because now we have the sure. list of the by pages, and it's much easier to find them that way than the sections and ranges and township. And then, do you have information on the status of acquiring the right-of-way for the pump station?
I believe the previous witness stated that it's in negotiation, but I don't have any firsthand knowledge, no.
Okay, and then do you have information on the status? Here's what my notes reflected, that, and I meant to clarify with him further, but that Hess had reached out to McKenzie County to see what permits may be needed for the middle booster station, but has not yet applied for any. So is there a dispute about whether they're needed or not, or waiting for an answer from McKenzie County, or do you know anything?
I'm not directly involved in that. My understanding is that the schedule has been pending, so that could have an influence on their reaching out to the county regarding those permits.
Okay. At some point, I'll need a little more information on that. I have no other questions.
Okay. Anything else from Ms. Schmidt, Mr. Mann?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Armstrong?
One second. I'm trying to figure out these waivers. I'm looking at Exhibit 11, and I figured out 9 and 10 going between maps here. I don't know if you can tell me or not, but Exhibit 11 is a waiver for Section 18 in Township 152, Range 95 West, and I can't figure out if it's the waiver for the occupied structure that's on both pages 1 and 2, or if it's for the occupied structure on page 3. I'm just curious if you're able to tell. It just looks too close to me.
Yeah, I can't tell with just glancing at it.
Okay. I would probably just want to update my request for a late file to be maybe not so specific to that one waiver, but to any outstanding waivers that there may be subject to check with the maps and review of the file. That's all the questions I have. Thank you.
Mr. Fine?
No questions. Thank you.
Commissioners, anything else for Katie Schmidt? Okay, Ms. Schmidt, you can step down. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Mann.
Yeah, I'll call Dale Weathersby.
Mr. Weathersby, before I swear you in, I'll have you spell your first and last name for the record.
D-A-L-E, Dale Weathersby, W-E-A-T-H-E-R-S-B-Y.
Okay, thank you. Now, you were here when I gave the perjury admonition?
Correct.
Okay, raise your right hand. You promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Yes, I do. Thank you.
Mr. Mann.
Dale, could you state your name for the record and give us your business address?
Dale Weathersby, 10384 68th Street Northwest, Tioga, North Dakota.
And what is your position with Hess?
Regulatory advisor.
And Dale, could you briefly describe your experience and your duties and responsibilities with Hess?
I'm an advisor to Hess to ensure compliance with regulated pipelines as it, particularly with PHMSA requirements. I have 35 years plus in oil and gas and steel industries.
Okay. And why don't we start with, you've heard there's been a number of questions with respect to the initial construction of the gathering lines. Do you have some familiarity with the initial lines being put in?
Yeah. Phase one and phase two of the Keene Oil Gathering System, construction ran concurrently with the work that was being done on the Hawkeye system. I got involved when phase two came on board, a six-mile segment of the Keene Oil Gathering System. It was constructed, I believe construction began around August of 2015. We had given notification to PHMSA about the Hawkeye conversion and work that was going on, and so I gave a courtesy or kind of informal notification to Nathan Solem with PHMSA that we were also doing work on this Keene system. Wasn't required to because of the length of the pipeline being less than 10 miles. However, when he was here, he did go by and look at construction, inspect construction that was going on with the Keene system.
So did Hess take any steps with respect to the initial gathering line with respect to identifying or protecting cultural and natural resources?
The survey was done by KLJ, both a desktop and a field survey.
Okay.
Identified wetland crossings, 11, I believe, 7 of which were potential waters of the U.S. In reading the summary of their report, no threatened or endangered species were encountered, no cultural areas were found.
And how were those crossings handled with respect to construction?
The recommendation was to be trenched or bored, and I assume that's what was done.
Okay. Do you know if some of them were bored? Or?
There are alignment sheets that show boring.
Yeah. Do you know, there was a question with respect to shutoff valves in their locations. Are you familiar with that? Or?
Somewhat. My understanding is there's an isolation valve at the Hawkeye Oil Facility, one at Midway Station, and one at the southern end of the Phase 2 pipeline around B.B. Olson.
Okay. And can you just briefly describe some of the steps that Hess took to mitigate impacts during construction of the original line?
Say again.
Can you identify some of the steps that Hess took to mitigate impacts during construction of the original line?
Impacts to?
Just any cultural natural resources.
I would have to refer to the stormwater prevention plan. Typically, we will do BMPs and that sort of thing.
Sure. And will the project have a monitoring system?
It will in a typical sense that we will do volume monitoring. In 2015, we conducted a process hazard analysis, and a recommendation came out of there that we do some sort of leak detection on the system. We looked at two different scenarios. One was the volume balance through metering. The second was a more sophisticated system such as a rarefaction or rarefaction wave system or acoustic system. Because our analysis of the pipeline route indicated that it did not directly impact or could impact a unusually sensitive area, as listed by MPMS. We decided that the volume balance was probably the best way to go.
Okay.
However, the scope has changed on this project since then, so the work is still ongoing, and so I think that decision is still, you know, whether we will stay with the volume or whether we will look at more detailed systems, you know, we may still choose to do that. I know spool piece was put in at the Hawkeye facility just in case we decided to do that.
Okay. And will Hess conduct any periodic inspections or surveillance and maintenance of the line?
We treat it typically like we do all of our DOT-regulated systems. With we do aerial surveillance 26 times per year with a not to exceed 3 weeks between frequency.
How about, like, inline inspections?
Again, because this area does not directly impact a USA, it would be a business decision whether we did or not. There is no risk indicator to show that we would need to do that. We have we do hydro tests, pressure tests, to prove the integrity and establish the MOP. So, again, it's a business decision.
Okay. I have no further questions for Mr. Weatherby at this time.
Mr. Armstrong.
Mr. Weatherby, during the testimony, you were talking about the construction of the original gathering line, and it sounds to me like you kind of came on after some of it was already started. Is that correct?
Phase one had been done.
And then you came on phase two?
Yes.
And were you involved at all during the construction of the Crestwood line?
We did not construct Crestwood.
What I'm trying to gather is we do have certain tree and shrub mitigation specifications. And looking at the maps, the pipeline goes through various areas of trees and shrubs. And the company's agreed to abide by those specifications. And what I'm wondering is what sort of information we would go about evaluating to see, like, what trees and shrubs were disturbed by the construction and how we can go about evaluating and replacing those if it's approved.
I'm not aware of any information currently on tree and shrub mitigation.
So Ms. Schmidt testified that they have that inventory for the Crestwood portion of the line because their information was before, but does Hess keep records at all of, like, any, like, pictures during construction, anything like that of those areas or not?
I could not say.
Do you know if KLJ's first, do you know the scope of what KLJ's work was on the gathering line?
I knew they did a desktop survey and then a field survey for areas that crossings.
Okay. So, and that's kind of what I thought. So KLJ's field survey wasn't like the entire length of the gathering line. It was for the water body crossings, the
correct.
Wetland crossings.
Correct.
And so we basically kind of have to use mapping and other information available to determine, you know, probably site inspections as well, to determine, you know, what areas of trees and shrubs were impacted by construction of the gathering line. Is that probably fair?
I think that would be fair.
During your discussion, and maybe I just missed the acronym, I'm not sure, but it was, and I forgot what question was from, but you said that we did B&Ps and that sort of thing. I wasn't sure what that was. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
What is that?
B&P is
EMP?
Yeah, typically these, what do you call them, these cellulose logs that you prevent erosion in soil.
So that, yes, now I remember. It was in the surface water runoff part of what you were talking about. So what you were saying was to not impact maybe any sensitive sites away from where the trench was being dug, you would have those BMPs surrounding both sides of the construction?
We would do it wherever there was a drainage, and again, our stormwater program would typically indicate where those were necessary.
So it's, so just so I'm clear, it's based off of where the analysis shows they're needed. It's not the entire route of the gathering.
That's correct.
Is there a particular person at Hess who was involved in the original construction of the gathering line that's still with the company?
I can't answer that.
I don't know. Who did you work with at Hess when you were got involved at Phase 2? Do you know who the project manager was or any of the key people?
Rick Cotrer and Marty Koopman. They're both now employed by Statoil.
I'll turn over to Mr. Fahn while I look at my notes so I don't have everybody sit and watch me do that.
Mr. Fahn.
Okay.
I just have a couple. Has the company notified PHMSA of the time frame for converting the pipeline?
Yes. When we began construction on the two-mile connection for Johnson's Corner, to go from Johnson's Corner to Crestwood, as part of that notification, I put in the fact that we would be doing a flow reversal in addition to booster pumps for the Keene Oil Gathering System.
Okay. Would the company commit to, whenever a spill requires notification to any other state or federal agency, but also inform the commission of the spill within 24 hours with a follow-up email?
I see no reason why we wouldn't.
Do you know of any report regarding the reclamation and revegetation restoration after the gathering pipeline project?
No, I do not.
So my understanding is that the route is continually reviewed by employees.
We have flyovers every 2 weeks.
Flyovers. No, nothing on the ground.
Not unless there's an indication that's needed.
Are you aware of any trouble spots for the reclamation work? The system that you were talking about to monitor for leaks, I think you said it was a volume.
It would be a volume balance.
Volume balance. That is, there isn't any type of system like a SCADA. You're familiar with the word term SCADA system that monitors this pipeline?
I can't speak to the SCADA system at this point, because of all the build-out that's going on. So I don't know what percent completion they are or where they're at with it.
Perhaps we could get some information about whether this system if there's a SCADA system that has surveillance of the system and control of the system.
Yes, we can look into that.
As a late file.
As a late file, right. Let's see. I'm thinking that another witness will will talk about coordination of emergency and incidents with local authorities. And
that's correct. Mr. Badon can speak to that.
Do you know? Oh, I think we have a late file exhibit coming on the depth of cover. So that'll be taken care of.
Well, he may know. Yeah, I guess he wouldn't know the phase one part.
Typical construction standard is 5 foot.
Do you know if that was followed for the gathering system?
I know the question was asked during the PHMSA inspection, and there was no issue with it. There was no finding from it, so I suspect we provided it. I don't have it with me today.
I believe that's all the questions I have. Thank you.
Okay. Questions from the commissioners. Commissioner Fedorchak.
Thank you, Dale. Regarding the monitoring system, can you provide more information about what the volume control monitoring, tell me about it.
It's
how does it work? How sensitive is it? Type of thing.
I'm not an expert on on those types of meters, but what you will do is basically take the output from the wells or from the lacs. You'll have a meter there that shows what's going into the line, and then at the end where your sales point is, or some stage along the line, you'll be able to balance between what is going in and what is passing that discharge point.
So, seeing how this, there's a lot of on-ramps for this. Do you know how many?
Offhand, I don't. There are several laterals, I believe 3 or 4.
Okay, so there would be a metering system there that would be feeding the endpoint system?
Yes.
And that would be adding up the total volumes and making sure that what's coming in is going out. So
correct.
Something that how often are those volume measurements taken?
I want to say the balance could take as long as 24 hours.
Really?
Yeah. Well, you're dealing with
it. You could have a leak for 24 hours and not know about it.
Yes. The reason being, gathering systems typically have slack in the line. Excuse me.
Take your time.
The line itself is not in steady state. So with that slack in the line, rarefaction waves and acoustics, it's very difficult to operate. The reliability is really tough. And so the default method that has been used for, you know, in industry for a long time has just been that volume balance.
Mm-hmm.
The technology with some of the meters like the Corioluses give you a fairly high degree of accuracy, but there is still that time lag.
Mm-hmm. Well, and when it's a gathering system and not pressurized, the volumes are lower, so that might
correct.
Be adequate, but I question whether that would be adequate when you've got a maximum, a higher operating pressure. And from what I recall reading, the capacity of the line is 100,000 barrels per day.
Yeah. Does it mean we'll be operating at that, though?
No.
Maybe operating at 20.
Correct. But you could be.
We could be. And it would be great if it were stacked, if that line were stacked.
Yep.
It's probably not going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
So you're going to get us, you said about the SCADA system, and I know there's a lot of difference in what a SCADA system can be and what it can mean and how effective it is. So just saying there's a SCADA system doesn't necessarily, shouldn't necessarily be like a a lot of comfort, but it does suggest that it's monitored 24/7 and somebody's looking at that. So this volume metrics is who's monitoring that and where are they located and how are they controlling the line?
I can't speak to that. I would assume our operations folks are looking at those numbers, not continuously, but at least on a periodic basis.
Okay. And the operations folks are the folks that would detect the leak then? Do they have control over the system? Could they shut it down remotely, or how would you shut it down?
It would be done manually.
Okay. And where are those people based, or where would be the nearest person to the line to go out and shut it down manually?
We have personnel in and around this area, you know, Watford City and Keene.
Okay. So they're close.
Yes.
Tell me about this unusually sensitive area designation. That's first I've heard that used in 5 years of permitting pipeline. And who makes this, and what does that mean to the company in terms of its how it determines the leak detection that's needed?
National Pipeline Mapping System designates areas of unusual sensitivity. It's part of Part 195 PHMSA.
Okay. And that, I guess I have heard of it in that regard, but I haven't heard it applied to a company's decision-making on leak detection systems. So can you talk through that a little bit?
We go, when we have an area like that, we will put additional resources to bear on that because of the added risk of that unusually sensitive area.
And can you give me some examples of an unusually sensitive area?
There are areas around Stanley.
So is it water related? Or is it?
Typically, they can be drinking water intake areas. They can be wetlands. They can be rivers.
Okay. Well, I'm thinking of the spill in the farmer's field in Tioga. That probably wasn't an unusually sensitive area.
Which one?
The big spill by the Tesoro experience that was discovered by the farmer.
Of Tioga.
By Tioga. That would not have been an unusually sensitive area.
I do not believe.
But it would have been a leak that would have been valuable to detect a lot sooner than they did. I think we'd all agree. The cost of the company has been exorbitant to clean that all up. So I guess bottom line, I just need to know more about the company's leak detection system on this line before we approve increasing the pressure and the amount of oil that's going to be flowing through it, whether it's usually or unusually sensitive areas or not.
The recommendation came out when we were only looking at the Keene Phase 1 and Phase 2 systems. And again, along with that original recommendation was a consideration for a volume balance or a more elaborate system. We still have that option, I guess, if business believes that that's the way we should go. Of taking that. Mm-hmm. And with the addition of and the reversal of flows and the added volumes and all of that, and again, like I say, it would be a business decision.
Okay. Well, then maybe the company should provide that information to us in the late file exhibit and update its plans. Maybe the business decision has already been made to go that route, and that would be helpful to know. One final question for you. Two. I didn't see in the application any statement that the original line was built to the DOT standards, the 195. I forget the exact terminology, Pat. You could probably rattle it off. Section 195.
Part 195.
Part 195.
The federal regulations.
Yeah. So can you confirm that that's the case on this line, that it was built to those standards?
Yes.
Okay, the original gathering line.
Yeah.
Okay. And then tell me about the corrosion control measures that exist on this system. Does it have cathodic protection?
It does have cathodic protection, but I don't have a lot of information in front of me.
Okay.
We'll be cathodically protected. We will conduct annual surveys, CIS, and whatever is required.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I think that concludes my questions.
Okay. Mr. Kosis.
Well, thank you, Dale. You indicated that you have a number of years of experience as a regulatory advisor, very familiar with PHMSA. Would that be an accurate statement, our PHMSA requirements?
Yes.
Would you say you're equally familiar with North Dakota requirements in terms of construction techniques and a number of other things?
I believe so.
You had mentioned something on the Hawkeye piece. I take it back. What piece was that you were referring to? Do you recall you had indicated something earlier that a piece was installed at Hawkeye just in case? It sounds like a safety feature was put in, or was it the ability to expand?
Yeah, the recommendation was to install a school piece where the Hawkeye oil facility was, okay, so that we could either put in Coriolis meters or any type of metering, such as an Atmos system or that type of thing. In other words, we left that space intentional there so that we could do work as the system grew.
Would that be to have the potential to move it from a gathering to transmission line?
I don't know that it would affect any of that.
So that it's not tied to?
No, it would just be for monitoring the line.
Okay. Now, going back to the response time, you had indicated that there could potentially be a problem that it would exist for a period of 24 hours. And then on top of that, there would be response time. And that is certainly worst-case scenario. If we wanted to talk worst case, 100,000 barrels are flowing through the line. It could be undetected if there was a problem for 24 hours plus response time to get things shut down. How quickly do you think people can move to shut the system down once a problem is recognized?
We have typically listed 1 hour for response time once the problem is identified.
Now, in terms of, it sounds like you know how much is going into the system at the very beginning at the gathering line points. And then that's compared to the measurement at the sales point, I believe you described it as.
Correct.
So there isn't a measurement taken at the entry point of the transmission?
Not that I'm aware of.
Wouldn't that make sense to have a meter? So it's not, it just seems so broad to try and backtrack. Where is the exact problem at?
Yeah.
I mean, you can shut the line down, of course, but wouldn't that?
Problem is you have multiple well pads that feed into a lateral, and that lateral feeds into the line. And so you would have to go in and put valving somewhere along that lateral to do that.
And there are quite a number of those throughout the entire stretch of line, essentially, if it's all around pads.
Yeah, there are at least three or four laterals that go into that line.
Okay. So best case from a monitoring standpoint, if there were meters at those three or four locations, that would further isolate or And then what would response time be if that did exist? Would it be down to the hour, on the hour, in terms of getting things shut down if there's a problem?
I don't know that it would change that response time any. It would just help you isolate where the system was leaking.
Yeah, I'm just trying to have a greater degree of confidence that if there is a problem, and you think, well, that's worst case, and from a business standpoint, I know it would be.
Industry and the state of North Dakota have spent a lot of money trying to get a best practice on leak detection.
Right.
ERC has done a lot of work on it, and we've been involved in that.
You have?
Yes.
For how long have you been working with EERC?
Since the inception of this governor's initiative. They recently did a phase three, I think. You know, there was a meeting last week and at Hess and Tioga, but I wasn't involved there. Okay. I was out of state at the time.
Okay, and then the last thing, you had indicated that in terms of, not that we ever want to get to this point, but if any type of a spill does occur, that you would notify the PSC within 24 hours.
Certainly we can add it to our response plans. There's no issue there.
All right. No other questions for me.
Commissioner Christman.
I think, Your Honor, that all my questions have been asked and answered, unless... Dale, if as a regulatory advisor, do you deal with the county on local permits?
No, I don't.
Someone else? Okay. Then I'll save that. Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Mann.
I have no further questions.
Sure, I'm sure.
Nothing.
Mr. Fine. One.
You've done a lot of work with the ERC.
Yes.
On the leak detection. So I was just kind of wondering, on a scale of like 1 to 10, how would you rank this system as far as being able to detect a leak because of everything coming in and, you know, all the gathering lines coming in? Is this like an example of a real tough situation to find a leak detection?
Say that again.
Is this an example of a system that it would be tough to detect a leak?
Again, we get back to gathering systems because of the way they're operated and having the potential for slack in the line. You don't have a stacked line. It's just very difficult, and the EERC reflected that in, I think, their phase two study on gathering lines. But traditionally, this is the way gathering lines have been operated with these volume balances. Is it the best case? I don't know. There's a cost benefit there. You can spend a ton of money. Will you absolve enough risk to outweigh that? I don't know. As your systems grow and expand, then obviously that risk is increased, and that's kind of what we've seen with this system. We started out originally with a very small system. Now it's expanded. In fact, it's reverse direction and everything else. And that's why I think we're looking at possibly revisiting what type of, you know, system we do install. We still have the potential for, or at least the ability to do, a volume balance. But it may be that as we see market demands increase and volumes increase, the potential would be there to have a more sophisticated system.
Do you currently have measurement on the gathering, everything coming into the transmission line, or what will be the transmission line in the future, like all the gathering lines? And
I couldn't answer that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Commissioners, anything further?
Not for me.
Mr. Crocious.
I do have one. Not quite off the hook yet, but you're close. I sense it. And you can help me out with this. the Keystone line in South Dakota, that site in South Dakota that had the spill, the spill occurred. They had the line shut down in 5 minutes, if I remember correctly, of noticing a drop in pressure. Something to that. I don't know if they were measuring pressure or if they were measuring inbound versus outbound. But within 5 minutes, they noticed that, and they shut the line down. And still, it was a larger volume flowing through the pipe, et cetera. The spill was substantial. But the response time was very, very quick. I realize there are economics involved. You can tell me to what extent. But at the same time, why couldn't that type of system be put in place for this line so that the response time was, and I realize you're talking manual shutoffs, but I believe they had to manually shut those down too. But anyway, I think we get the gist of the question.
The Keystone line is a non-gathering line. It's basically a transmission line.
Right.
So they do control room management. They have a person sitting in front of a screen 24/7 monitoring that pipeline. Completely different type of animal than what a gathering system would be.
But this is a 19-mile transmission line is what you're asking for.
It's transmission
fed by gathering. I understand that.
Yeah. If we could keep a steady state and keep that line packed with volumes from extra tankage or that sort of, to ensure that that line remains packed, which is what Keystone was.
Okay.
Then we could do that. No question.
So
chances are we're not going to.
It's going to fluctuate on the hour?
It's going, yeah.
On the day or on
the hour, half hour, the volumes will fluctuate.
From a percentage basis, how much does it fluctuate or is it all over the board?
It'll be depending on what the demand is.
Okay.
The two systems are fairly dissimilar.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll admit I need to go back and do a little more homework on that. I recognize I'm following some of the points you're making, but I want to do a deeper dive into it.
Mr. Fedorchuk.
I appreciate your honesty, Dale, in recognizing that this isn't a typical transmission system. It also isn't the first time we've had one of these where a conversion from a gathering, which has all the on-ramps to a transmission line, creates these kind of monitoring challenges. So tell me more, since you're involved in the ERC, because I think this is one of the difficulties that ERC study is specifically focusing on. So what are some of the, I won't even hold you to like you're going to be using them here, but what are they? What are some of the options for improving the monitoring of these types of systems, which is probably going to be a fair number of in North Dakota, to increase the likelihood of having a speedy detection and quick response on a leak?
Yeah, my understanding is they're still doing research on the different types of technologies. Again, it's not a cut and dried answer. If it was, everybody would be doing it. They've looked for everything from nanotechnologies to all sorts of things. One of the systems out there and a system that we have installed on a couple of our pipelines is that rarefaction wave, and the company's name is Atmos. Again, the degree of reliability depends upon how stacked, in fact, you can keep that line. They will say that you can use it on gathering. and that's why we've chosen to use it in the past. And it's probably something we would look at here as well. Mm-hmm. But as far as a cut and dried answer of, well, you should use this, it's just not there. No one has been able to come up with that silver bullet yet.
And is that system you described cost prohibitive?
Not really. Not really. Again, it would depend upon the risk involved. Mm-hmm. And if you have a huge cleanup, then obviously it's not very cost prohibitive at all.
Yeah, right. Like the best thing, best decision ever. Okay, then this is just randomly came to mind. It was something we didn't talk about earlier, and you may or may not be the person to talk about it, but when the original gathering line was built, can you speak to the company's procedures for X-raying the welds? Is that something you do on gathering lines? And
we do 100% NDE X-ray on girth welds. All of our procedures, at least on the Phase 2 project, I know, and from then on, were procedures that were reviewed and accepted by PHMSA.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll look forward to your late-filed exhibit for your latest and greatest plans for the monitoring system on this line. Thank you.
Anything else for Mr. Weatherby? Okay, sir, you can step down. You've got one more witness.
One more.
And I think we'll just go right through with that witness. There are a couple members of the public that indicated they want to testify briefly, so I'd like to keep going because they've been waiting a long time.
Sure. And we don't have a lot for this witness.
Okay. I'd like to keep going in spite of the fact that there's some pretty good smells coming from
the
I know.
I'll keep it brief.
Okay. State your name, please.
Benjamin Badon.
And spell the last name, please.
B as in boy, A, D as in delta, O-N.
Okay. And you were here when I gave the perjury admonition today?
I was.
Okay, raise your right hand. You promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Okay. Mr. Mann.
All right. Ben, can you go ahead and give us your business address?
Sure. It's 3015 16th Street, Southwest, Suite 20, Minot, North Dakota, 58703.
And, Ben, what's your position with us?
I am the emergency response advisor, as well as the environmental health and safety technical authority for our training and competency group.
And could you just briefly describe your education, experience, and your duties and responsibilities with HESS?
Sure. I'm a certified safety manager. I have 23 years in emergency response, and I'm responsible for the emergency response planning, training, drills, exercises, as well as incident management if an incident does occur.
And you would be responsible for incident management and emergency response with respect to this particular pipeline?
I would.
Okay. Will all of the HESS personnel responsible for the transmission line and associated facilities be trained in emergency response procedures?
They would, in varying levels. The personnel out there in the field would be trained in the emergency response plan. That's our lowest level emergency response organization. It's based on a three-tier emergency response organization. The first tier, emergency response plan. The second tier, the incident management plan, managed by the incident management team, which is basic, your basic incident command structure that's used in both public and private entities. And then the next level, the Houston incident support team, or our corporate plan. The next level up from that, our supervisors out in the field would be trained in 24-hour HAZWOPER in order to manage and oversee spill response activities. And all of our incident management team personnel are trained not only in ICS, but also their position-specific roles in relation to the plan.
Sure. And do you have an emergency response plan in place for this particular project?
There are a number of different plans in place. There's the stormwater pollution prevention plan. There's the spill prevention and control countermeasures plan. There's also the unanticipated discovery plan. How do we keep the oil into the pipeline or secondary containment? And then if something were to occur, we have our emergency response plans and our incident management plan.
So what about communications with local emergency responders? Do you do any training or drills with those folks?
We do, not only with McKenzie County, but also all the counties in which we operate. Specifically with McKenzie County, we attend their quarterly local emergency planning committee meetings, as well as the North Dakota Pipeline Association meetings, and we actively have them participate in our exercises. In fact, our last full-scale exercise was in August of last year. It was a pipeline scenario, and we had McKenzie County, Carolyn Jaffe participating, as well as McKenzie County Sheriff, and also we had Department of Health, the Industrial Commission personnel participating not only in the office but also out in the field where we're deploying equipment. The three affiliated tribes, Mr. Travis Hallam participated in that, Army Corps of Engineers, and, of course, our spill response contractor, SWAT Consulting.
I have no further questions for Mr. Bedalian.
It's Bedalian.
Bedalian.
It's okay. Sorry. Any friends, you have to make sure you get my last name right.
It was great I heard you.
Apologize, Ben.
Sorry.
Bedalian.
Mr. Armstrong.
I just have a couple, but it sounds to me, Mr. Bedalian, like your position involves both responding to an emergency and preparing
for it, yes.
To avoid an emergency or being prepared to respond.
Being prepared to respond, yes, sir.
So I was going to ask you if you were involved at all in some of the prevention of spills that we were just asking Mr. Weathersby about.
No, sir. I would strictly be on, if something were to happen, how we respond, how quickly we respond to it.
During Mr. Weathersby's testimony, he was asked some of the response times if there's a spill. Could you tell us, from your position, the response times for this line in this area?
Well, I can't talk to how quickly we would be able to shut down the line because that's not under my remit, but I can tell you what the typical response time for our response contractors would be. Is that where you're going? So, twofold. So we have an on-call incident management team that need to be able to respond once they are activated to our offices within 1 hour in order to effectively manage the spill. But our spill response contractors, such as SWAT Consulting, Barranco, Basin, Clean Harbors, MSRC, they, depending on where it is, they strategically place equipment and personnel around that area, especially our Sasser equipment. Hess is a member of the Sakakawea Area Spill Response Cooperative that strategically places equipment around in order to decrease the amount of our response time. So typically you're going to have a response in those three counties, McKenzie, Williams, and Mount Rail. I've seen it within an hour, sometimes within a half an hour, depending on where the location is.
And that's upon notification, of course.
Exactly, once we find out about it, right. And we have a notification system that we utilize our 24/7, 365 Tioga control room operators. It's a 1-800 number that no matter where the spill is, whether it's someone from the public who identifies it or one of our own personnel, they call that number, and we do twice a month notification drills to ensure that that communication system works in a timely manner.
Does your purview and cover spills for both gathering lines and transmission lines?
It does.
Have you had any spills or any cleanup with respect to this line that we're here for today?
This line, no, sir. Oh, real quick. In regards to your question earlier about the notification to the NDIC, if you want to, I don't want to be the only person who doesn't have exhibits, but if you go into the exhibit for the incident management plan, Section 4.3 specifically has a notification matrix where we identify the agencies that we would be required to contact in the cases of a spill, and NDIC is, of course, listed on there.
We're asking about the PSC, though.
Oh, PSC.
Add the PSC to that. Sure, we can definitely do that, yeah. You know, in addition to, we make the notification to the National Response Center. They, of course, are kind of like the 911 call center for the entire nation. They send out notifications to those entities that have jurisdiction in those areas. So I'd be surprised to see if PSC wasn't already on the distribution list from the NRC. But if it's not, we can definitely add them as a courtesy call.
I was asking about any spills from, and I don't want to necessarily confine it because there is a gathering system that goes into this proposed conversion line, which is part of the problem with detecting if there's been a leak. But, I mean, just this has this gathering system feeding to this line that is being proposed to be converted. Has there been any spills in that system?
We have responded in the past to flow line spills, right? Yes, we have. So
what have you found to be, I mean, does it take a long time to recognize them and to get people out there to take care of them? I mean,
once the incident is identified, it does not take long to respond. Because of our notification system and because of the robust amount of response personnel that we have.
And I understand that when you've had these incidents, do you go out there and recognize this has been going on for a long time, or do you go out there and say, glad we caught this quick, you know, if you can break that down in some way for us?
Right. Knock on wood, we haven't had that many spills within the last, I'd say, as far as, like, major spills that would require a large cleanup, we've only had a couple, and in those couple, I can fairly comment on the response aspect of it, not necessarily the detection. So I'm having a hard time with that. I know that once we are notified, I can verify how long it takes us to respond. I don't want to speculate on how long it took them to identify it because that's not really my purview. My purview is strictly on the response.
Thank you. That's all the questions I have.
Mr. Fine.
Yes, just a couple. Are you required to hold these planning sessions and drills with the local responders and McKenzie County, for example?
Yeah, we are. And we take it to the point where we are required to, one, make sure that they have copies of our plans, to the point where once a year, especially with DOT-regulated lines, I provide each county that we have those lines in with a, I call it a DOT information plan. And basically it gives them a GIS map of where those lines are located, as well as the emergency response procedures on who to contact within HESS if they do identify a leak, if we don't know about for some reason. And then we also provide them with the safety data sheets for the materials that are being transported through those lines.
And how often do you have to review those plans?
Well, I review them with the county on a yearly basis, but if something comes up, like a new line were to come in, I'd make an exception and meet with the counties with those new lines. But going back to your other question, are we required to meet with the counties, right, to do planning and stuff like that? There is a requirement for us to produce the plans to them, but we've taken upon ourselves, you know, is it the right thing to do? So, yes, it is the right thing to do, and that's why we do it. We include them in our plans, in developing our plans, as well as the exercise of our plans, to see if there's any feedback from them on how we can improve it. And that's why we do exercises. So we encourage, and we have participation from the counties whenever we do those exercises.
And those are once a year?
We do two exercises a year.
Two exercises a year.
And we also do two equipment deployment drills a year as well.
And that's all I have. Thank you.
No worries.
Okay, commissioners. Commissioner Fedorchik.
Just one question for you. Could you... Typically on these types of projects, pipeline permits, we ask for spill history for the company. Is that something you could provide?
I believe our regulatory department could provide that to you. Yes, ma'am.
That would kind of cover everything. Then we can just look at that and get the full scope. And otherwise, I think all my other questions have been answered. Thanks.
Sure. In addition to that, whenever we have a large enough spill, we have to activate our incident management team. We conduct a full after-action report. And so if there's a spill that brings it up to that level, we can provide that to you as well.
Okay. Very good. Thanks.
Commissioner Kosius.
All right. Well, thank you, Ben. Just so you know, don't take this personally, but you're really the last person I think we want to be talking to, because then it's too late.
I feel the same way. Yeah.
But obviously, it's good that you're in place. Do you do any of the cleanup? Can you do the cleanup as well when there's a
spill? That's correct, yes. I oversee the response and remediation of the release.
All right. Okay. You had mentioned several instances where the parts of the gathering system, a leak occurred. Is that correct?
I wouldn't say several. No, I've been involved in at least where we've had to stand up the team, the incident management team, to that level, and that I've been participated in. It's been one within the last 3 years that I've been here.
Okay. Volume?
Right now it's about, I'd say it was around 70 barrels at the most. We're still trying to identify the exact amount.
All right. Is the landowner satisfied with the remediation efforts?
Yes.
So if I were to go have coffee with them at the they'd say this has been...
In fact, that's one of the things we do satisfaction. In the incident management team structure. One of the positions on there is called the liaison officer. Their entire function is to notify and maintain communication with the stakeholders, such as the landowners, Department of Health, NDIC, and all the alphabet soup of response agencies, right? So they make it a point not only to notify them, but to keep in touch with them and let them know if there's anything that could impact them adversely, or just to keep them informed. And so from the last bill that I know where we had to engage with the landowner, it was a very positive experience. Any questions that they had, we were very forthright with, and we kept them up to date constantly.
All right. Thank you very much. No other questions for me.
Commissioner Chrisman.
Just one, Your Honor. Is that Secaucus, we...
Area Spill Response Cooperative?
Yes, sir. That's what I'm talking about. Is that just about a spill that would reach Secaucus itself, or and everyone around it participates in case something could happen that would eventually flow there, or do you also focus on smaller spills that never reach Secaucus?
Well, there could be smaller spills that never reach Secaucus, and if I were to call Sasser and say, look, I need the equipment from Conoco, from Marathon, or one of the other companies that's a member company, they'd be like, yeah, fine, that's okay, because not only does it cover Lake Secaucus, but from what I understand, it covers any tributaries to Lake Secaucus. Now, the spills that typically occur on land wouldn't require all of those resources. It's very rare that you would have a spill on there that require that many resources, that I would have to go to the member companies of the cooperative and get that amount. So typically, yes, it's for Lake Secaucus and its tributaries, but I don't see how any of the member companies would turn down a request from any other member companies to use their equipment or the equipment of SWAT if it were a spill solely on land.
Thank you. Commissioner Fedorchuk.
Sorry, I have one more question, Ben, and that is in the modeling of your work, I think typically you have to do a worst-case spill scenario. Is that available for this line yet, or when it is available, can you file it with us?
Right. So a worst-case discharge scenario is used for lines where – not all lines. It would be the worst-case discharge for all of our lines. In other words, what's the worst-case scenario for the largest line in that we operate? This would not be one.
I thought you had to do them on each transmission line or each line. Maybe it's only each line that PHMSA really cares about.
I would have to defer to Dale with seeing if that was done, but I focus on the worst-case for my planning, the worst-case discharge that we could possibly face. So that's the type of equipment that I would make sure that I would have the capability for. And anything less than that, well, then, yes, we have that capability for that. So if I plan for the worst-case, largest pipeline ever, in the most severe, the most ecologically sensitive area, if I plan for that, then anything else, of course, would be less than that. And I'm totally prepared for that. Possibilities.
Okay. If Dale wants to just let us know if one is available for this line, that'd be great.
That's right.
Okay. Mr. Mann, any follow-ups?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Armstrong?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Fine? No,
thank you.
Commissioners? No. Okay, thanks, Mr. Bedine. Very helpful. Mr. Mann.
I guess if I could, Dale, do you know the answer to this case discharge?
I'll recall
Mr. Weathersby.
Yeah, I'll have you come back up to the microphone. I'll remind you, you're still under oath. And Mr. Weathersby, you can proceed and answer Mr. Mann's question.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you, you heard the question from Commissioner Fedorchak with respect to worst-case discharges. Is there something like that for this particular line?
Not that I'm aware of. Worst-case discharge scenarios would only be applicable to those that have open 90 plans where you can impact water. And so we've not done that.
Okay.
We do have it for the river crossing on the Hawkeye systems.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay. So he's got another question?
No, I didn't know if there's any other follow-up.
Any follow-up?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, fine. Okay, thanks, Mr. Weathersby. Okay, Mr. Mann. Next steps.
I have no further witnesses. We've offered the exhibits. That's all I have with respect to presentation of our case.
Okay. Mr. Armstrong?
We have no witnesses, so I think it'd be time for public testimony.
Okay. Yep. We have a couple people out there. Mr. Talbert? Albert, I'll ask you to raise your right hand. You promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceedings?
I do.
Okay. And are you here? Oh, give me your name and address for the record.
My name is Jim Talbert. My address is 201 5th Street, Northwest, Watford City, North Dakota.
Okay. And are you here representing any entity or group?
I am. I am the Planning and Zoning Director for McKenzie County.
Okay, what is it that you want to tell us today?
I would like to just go over a few things in general, if I could. First, I'd like to express gratitude to this commission, the support and communication that we in the county receive from the PSC is greatly appreciated. As you're well aware, two different arms in oil and gas, NDIC and the PSC. And I'll just say that this commission is much more open to providing information, which we do greatly appreciate. I have been working for the county for about 3 years now, though I have about 30 years of experience as a land planner. And prior to coming here, never had the opportunity to work with oil and gas industry, and so it has been somewhat of a crash course, and each time I think I have it figured out, I find out that I'm missing another piece of the pie. I am tasked with the county commissioners to keep them updated on hearings from the PSC, the NDIC, and health department of anything that they may wish to respond to that is coming up. I have notified my board, actually now I think three different meetings of this upcoming hearing, and they did not have any concerns beyond those that we have, just generally. We do strongly support the industry. I would tell you that we are proud of the part that McKenzie County plays in the economics of the state and the nation, the part we play with the industry. We do try to be a cooperative with what is going on. In saying that, though, there are real impacts that we do face each day from the oil and gas industry. And, you know, they include everything from our roads to our schools to infrastructure, smells, sounds. There's just a wide variety to replacing our windshields twice a year. You know, and like I say, these are real impacts that are felt by the people here. We appreciate when industry steps forward and recognizes those additional impacts and when they work cooperatively with the county. I will tell you that we support the conversion of gathering to transmission as a general rule, because often we don't know where the gathering lines are. But we do, once these hearings are held, we know where they are and know that we have an opportunity to address any concerns. We do try to encourage greater interaction with the county and the community by various industry members. To answer a few questions that I have heard posed here, we do require zoning on transmission lines and pipelines and facilities in the county. And so as these particular lines are converted from gathering to transmission, they will need to come forth with a zoning application, typically a conditional use permit, and be able to address the Planning and Zoning Board and then further the county commissioners to the plans for these facilities. One of the questions that or concerns that we get regularly have to do with flaring, and I realize that that's more on the NDIC side, but there are typically flares associated with these transmission facilities also, and so any amount of new facilities that reduce flaring, the light, the sound, often these flares have the sound of a jet engine, and it is a complaint that we get regularly from our citizens. Just recently, and this is just within the last month, in an effort to try to improve the flow of work here in the county, I had looked at our requirements, because I do planning and zoning. I'm also over building permits and inspections and fire and safety inspections. And over the 3 years I've been here, I have looked at what I would consider a high level of safety in the industry in general, and appreciate what they have gone through. I had to ask myself, are my inspections improving safety, or are there sufficient guidelines that are being followed where, you know, my inspections aren't adding to that? And I had to conclude that why inspections were offered slowing down the process. Just within the last month, we have amended our building code so that these facilities, oil and gas facilities, can apply for a waiver of building permit and inspections. As of right now, I have not received any of those applications, but like I say, it is a brand new. And so a lot of the compressor stations that may be associated with this line or other conversion lines or transmission lines, again, we feel there is great safety concerns in the industry, between OSHA, the American Petroleum Institute, and so on, that there are sufficient guidelines in place. And like I say, I have felt that often my inspections have slowed the process, and that is not our intent. We wish to keep things moving properly, at the same time making sure that we do have safe facilities. Some common concerns and requests that we have, this is not specific to Hess. They've been a good citizen here. They have worked with our emergency manager and done exercises and drills, which I know our emergency manager appreciates greatly. And so these concerns and or requests have to do with I would say, all facilities that we have. And we typically don't come before you unless the commission has asked me to do so. But it felt like this was an opportunity to let you know kind of where we are and that we wish to be an active partner with the PSC and the industry, and the NPSC for that matter. One concern that we have that we run into fairly regularly is often these facilities will start construction and or operations before receiving their permits or waivers or certificates of occupancies. That is going to become a less of an issue with the waiver process that we have implemented. But we do want these companies to come before us before it starts and let us express concerns that we might have or know of, get our questions answered. We are actively involved in paving and realigning roads. We have, I think it's 2,000 miles of dirt roads in the county. And we strive to get those paved, and often those pavings require realignments. We are concerned often about the depth of cover in and around roads, particularly where roads are coming up to a fairly tight corner. When we pave those, we increase the radius of those curves, and often if the pipeline is in place, that depth can be a problem for us and the companies. We would also request that, when there is a spill, that our emergency manager is notified also. She is in charge of the first responders or works with the first responders. And the more that we can communicate, the better off we are all along. We do request that, annual fire and safety inspections of the facilities. As I mentioned, we have a process in place to waiver building permits, but we do still conduct annual fire safety inspections. We also look to do annual drills with emergency manager and the fire departments. Our fire departments are all volunteer firemen, and so the more experience they have of what to do or what not to do is very beneficial to their safety. There's been a couple of questions concerning sound, and we would strongly support a way of coming up with a limit, and I don't know what that is, 50 decibels or something, where, you know, after it reaches a certain level that sound deadening modifications are put in place, because it, with our, you know, 5 trees in the county, the sound does travel fairly easily. We do require, along with zoning, a utility road crossing and section line crossing permits. Just so you're aware of that, whenever these lines cross a section line or cross underneath a county road, it does require a permit from our road and bridge department. One of the concerns that we hear often is weed control in areas that have been either cut for pipeline or graded off for pads or other facilities. And so we do have a active weed control board, and as these facilities are, again, they didn't have to come to the weed board as a gathering line, but as they now transfer into transmission, we want to just make sure that the weeds are kept to a minimum so they're not blowing into the rancher's fields. As we've heard today, there's often much turnover in the industry, and we appreciate the thorough nature that this commission takes. And I think it was Commissioner Crosas who mentioned that you look at it as if it's not in the ground. And I would tell you, we appreciate you looking at that, because there can be things that have changed. A few requests. We would request a thorough inspection of lines and facilities prior to being converted and turned over. I don't think that we are requesting any additional efforts beyond what would have been required if this project or any of these conversion projects had gone in, you know, as a transmission line day one. I'm unfamiliar with what all your requirements are, but if there are monitors that are required on traditional transmission line, we would ask that those get put on a gathering line. I don't think we are asking that more be done than what other transmission lines are doing, but we would like to see that same level be implemented. There was some talk of manual valves and shutoffs, and I am also familiar with other facilities I'm told they can detect it, you know, very quickly if there's a break. We would support automating valves that they could be shut off from a control center, as opposed to trying to locate, you know, where that break is. I guess in conclusion, it's just that when we look at the pipelines that are being converted from gathering to transmission, that we do have expectation, I think this commission does also, that the same level of safety and monitoring are in place prior to that conversion being allowed to move forward. With that, I have no other comments.
Hey, thanks, Mr. Talbert. Any questions for Mr. Talbert? Mr. Mann?
No questions. Thank you, Mr. Talbert.
Mr. Armstrong?
No questions. Thank you.
Mr. Fine?
Just curious about the road permits. Do you specify a depth of cover in road permits?
We do, and I don't know that answer. The road department has that, but I've often heard them speak of those problems as we are lining roads and the cover of depth approaching, coming in and out of the road section. But be happy to let you know what that is. I just don't know what it is myself.
I think that's all I have. Thank you.
Commissioner Fedorchuk.
Thank you, Jim. It's good to get an update on some of the things that you guys are seeing and hearing and continue to be concerned about, or new things that have popped up. So I appreciate it. I took notes and you had 10 items. So on one of the items, I think you're probably aware, but I just wanted to make you aware, just in case that you aren't, that the legislature in the last session changed the law and allows pipeline transmission lines to be permitted and allows us to supersede your requirements. So they don't have to come to you for the conditional use permit.
And I am aware of that.
Okay.
I didn't spell that out.
Yeah, that would apply in this case since it's a transmission line.
Correct.
And so how it's supposed to work, we notify you, which we did, and you let us know what your requirements are 10 days ahead of the hearing, and then we take those requirements into consideration in our permitting process. And so we want to make sure that we're following that and seeing, I mean, it is sort of a test period before the next legislative session to see if that's the best approach or if there's other tweaks that should be made. But our goal is not to ignore you or to not take into consideration, but really to make sure that your issues are covered here, so it's kind of like a one-stop shop for the companies.
We are aware of that. It was my understanding, and maybe I'm wrong, that dealt with the transmission pipelines.
That's what it is.
The facilities, does that include those facilities? Because we have been still requiring that of the facilities. And if I'm doing it wrong, we'll correct that.
You mean the booster stations and stuff? I mean, my understanding and my belief is that, and I'm not an attorney, so I'll let the attorney speak, but I would assume that they're all part of the pipeline, and so that's all covered in that new legislation.
Right.
But maybe some attorneys who can speak to that law might want to pipe in.
We are not trying to overstep.
Well, nor are we. We want to make sure everything's covered, but we, you know, it's new, and so there's going to be probably some hiccups along the way in what counties understand they need to do. My hope is that we err on the side of more communication, not less. If you have any concern, let us know and give us more information than we might need just to make sure that things are covered.
Yeah, and as I mentioned, we have been observing that with the pipelines, but the compressor stations or conversion facilities, we have been still requiring that. If that's improper, we will cease and desist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll want to clarify that. My understanding is they're all part of the same permitting process, but we don't distinguish at the PSC. Maybe if you guys do between the actual line and the facilities, that's probably an area that we need clarification. So thank you, Jim.
Crocious.
Well, Jim, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and communicating some really important points. I really especially like the one about being an active partner, because the reality is we get to go home, so to speak, at the end of a hearing. We live in Bismarck, but individuals like yourself, you have to talk to people, or you get to talk to people, I will say, as you're going, whether it's downtown to the cafe or whatnot, they're asking you questions. And your feedback is really, really helpful. So I appreciate your comments, and two is scribbling notes, and maybe I need to improve on my shorthand skills, but I think I'll be able to read most of it when I get home. But thank you, Jim. Appreciate it very much.
Commissioner Christman.
Well, also thanks, Jim. This was pretty thorough, but I was concerned on the company's testimony early on, something to the effect that they had reached out to McKenzie County about permits that may be necessary but hadn't applied for anything yet. Besides the things that we now approve in kind of coordination with the county, are you aware of anything specific that you feel this project needs from the county, not from us, that they have not applied for or not yet received?
No, they did come before us because they were building a new facility. I think it was there off of County Road 14. But as far as this pipeline, we do not have objections to this. We like pipelines versus trucks.
Sure.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Talbert. And now, Mr. Nelson, I know you had indicated an interest in coming forward. And now I'll have you raise your right hand. You promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
I do.
Thank you. I'm going to ask you just a couple of background questions for the record. If you could state your name, please.
Donald Nelson.
N-E-L-S-O-N?
Yes.
Okay. And where do you live?
I live in Keene. Do you need the address?
Yeah, just for the record, please.
3751 104th Avenue Northwest, Keene, North Dakota.
Thank you. And are you here representing any entity or group besides yourself today?
Yes, I'm kind of a dual today. I'm here as a board member and zoning administrator for Hawkeye Township, and then also for myself and my family as surface owners and mineral owners.
Okay. Now, are you within the 250-foot corridor? Was a waiver required from you personally?
For
this particular project?
No, we were notified for... as a township, we have our own zoning, which was put in place before McKenzie County's. I cannot say as far as residences. I know there's some very close to, like, Hawkeye facility. As far as the pipeline, I don't think there'd be anybody living within 250 feet of it. But there is some residences that we consider very close to these that, you know, we should represent those people in our township. So.
Okay. All right, Mr. Nelson, you can just go ahead and tell us what you want us to know.
I guess I have some questions and comments, I guess, that maybe will generate questions for you guys. We run under the county for pipelines for permitting, which now I feel that the state has overstepped their bounds and taken away some local control. But as far as the facilities, I believe that's two different animals, because those affect the people that are living in there a lot different than a pipeline does. So we have kept that right to zone and give permits for those facilities and for the roads. I guess one of my biggest questions here that comes to mind immediately with the changing of this from a gathering to a transmission line, how much more oil will be going through this, and how does it affect, any permits that we're giving, and all of the surface owners in their easement agreements. To me, this almost breaks those easements. Now, I know a good lawyer could probably go in there and argue on both sides of that, but as far as personally and my family, we give easements according to gathering and transmission, size of line, and how much oil goes through there. And if you're changing that, to me, that almost breaks that easement. We have a master agreement with Hess, our family, so that we don't have to negotiate each and every one, that we pretty much know what's going to happen when they come and we sign those easements. I guess the reason that I'm saying it breaks out is for a surface owner, he's signing an agreement according to whether it's how much oil, basically, or gas or salt water, whatever the pipeline is going through there, because that's the amount of liability for yourself on your land, what could happen if there is a problem. So the more that's going through that, the more liability you're taking on, and that is usually expressed in monetary terms. I guess the same thing for permits. You know, like I said, we don't permit. As a township, we decided when we did ours, we would leave that up to the landowners and the county if they did it in their zoning, which they did. Because as a township, we do not have the time or the resources. We would have to hire somebody full-time to do that. I never really heard how much difference this is going to make in the amount of oil that's going through this. The monitoring have a little bit of problem with, but I think the monitoring is coming around. I think we're getting better and better, and the state is pushing for better and better. 24 hours sounds like a long time, but maybe that's economically what can be done right now. The other thing on our township level is because Hawkeye facility is very close to some residences and we have to permit for roads, how much more truck traffic is going to come into that facility? Because they're saying it's trucked in now. Will there be more, or will this amount to more gathering lines going out, which affects surface owners within our township and that are not in our township? I do know the mono oil is going to increase. Just on my family's land alone, we know through negotiations with us that there's at least 6, I believe, new or expansion of sites on our land alone on this. I don't know. I'm sure it's just the same for all those other people in that area. And when I say pad or expansion, that doesn't mean one well. There's probably a minimum 3, 4 on up to don't know how many yet. So these are the questions I have about this, where they can come in and you can come in and change this from what was agreed upon in 2014. It's almost to me like this is breaking the easement agreements and the permits that were given at that time. As far as another thing I think about, I'm not so concerned about the spill of oil. I mean, unless it's a huge one, that can be remediated. Salt water is a whole lot different. But what concerns me is a catastrophic event with the facilities or the pumping stations or that. I don't believe, personally, my opinion, that any fire department in this county could do anything with that except try and clear people out and watch it burn. Who is going to come in and take care of that problem if, God forbid, it should happen? I don't think it will, but it's something that I think we need to think about. I guess with that, there was a lot of things came up as I was listening here. I probably forgot, but those are the main ones that I came for.
That's why we like you to have the opportunity to listen first and then have the opportunity to speak, because you may learn more about the project as they talk about it. Sometimes landowners, it'll raise their fears. Other times it gives them other concerns that they want to express. And that's why we come out to these areas, is so we can hear your input. So we really appreciate it. I'm going to ask you to stay there now, and I'm going to give the attorneys and the commissioners an opportunity to ask you some questions or comment in a little bit. So, Mr. Mann, any questions for Mr. Nelson?
No questions, thank you.
Mr. Armstrong?
I don't have any questions, thank you.
Mr. Fine?
No questions, thank you.
Commissioners, Commissioner Fedorchak.
Sure, thank you, Donald. Appreciate you being here and taking all the time. I know it's a time-consuming endeavor to sit through the hearings and avoid doing everything else that you've got on your plate for today. So we really do appreciate it and make better decisions now and in the future as a result of citizen input. So really appreciate it. Couple just thoughts on your concerns in terms of the breaking of the easements and the permits, breaking easements. We don't have a role in the easements. We don't have any leverage with the company on easements. So if there's easement language, they're beholden to maintaining the language of the easements and knowing what it is and abiding by it. And so they'll have to deal with the landowners directly on if there's changes required as a result. I'm sure each easement is slightly different. Maybe some have caps on throughput and others don't. Who knows? But that's not something that we get involved with at the PSC. In terms of the increased truck traffic or the normal throughput, according to what they applied in their application, and there was some potential indication from Dale today that this might be a lot less than this, but they state in their application that the normal daily throughput of the proposed project would be approximately 100,000 barrels per day. So that speaks to the volume that you were wondering about. They also say that indicate that this should be reducing truck traffic, or if you were to try to transport that amount of product without this, it would require 560 trucks per day. So that leads me to believe that there should be fewer trucks, but you did raise a good question as to whether there's going to be more trucks delivering to that Hawkeye facility, and that I don't have an answer for. That's a good question. So thank you very much for taking time. We'll get an answer on the conditional use permits that may or may not still be required by the locals. That's a question that I was very closely involved in monitoring that bill as it went through the legislative session, and I don't recall much conversation about that. But Danette from One Oak is here, and she was really intimately involved. She's in the back row. She might have more information on that because she was very intimately involved in that during the legislative session. And I also wanted to make sure that you understand that the PSC did not initiate that change. This was not something we sought or even advocated for or even testified in favor of during the legislative session. I personally am a strong supporter and believer in the local control and don't like superseding the local wishes. But to the extent that we knew that this was going to require us to be doing things, we were involved in that legislative process to make sure we, A, understood it, and, B, felt that it was something we could do. So we were involved in some of the drafting of the language to make sure that it was as good as possible for us for doing what we feel was going to be required. So thanks again, and stay tuned on that because there may be some tweaks in the next legislative session.
Commissioner Christman. Oh, I'm sorry, Commissioner Crochus, you can stay in the same order.
All right. Well, thank you, Don, for your comments. Really do appreciate them. Brought up some excellent points, and while we shudder to think about a catastrophic event, those things do happen from time to time, and And I don't have the here's exactly what happens in terms of response, but it's an excellent point. And I did have one question for you, and that is just landowner sentiment did you say you're in Hawkeye Township? Is that correct? Or that general area?
I have stuff all along the pipeline, so not just in Hawkeye Township.
Yeah. How would you describe landowner sentiment?
It varies. You talk to one person, and it varies by company. Some people. I'm going to put it on record, is I have not had very much trouble with Hess. We have a very good working relationship. I hear from other people that don't. But I don't have a very good working relationship with other companies that other people do. As far as the reclamation, I have to say this actual pipeline here was pretty good. I've seen worse. I've seen better. Hess has did an excellent job of late since then. Whoever they're using has been the best reclamation jobs I've seen on pipelines, except for the last year or so because of just the weather. They haven't been able to get anything, grass to grow and stuff, and that is not because it's not their fault, really, it's a environmental deal. I think that surface owners and landowners in this county have been so bombarded that they don't even take an interest anymore. I really believe that. Compared to what it was years ago, it's just been a bombardment over the last 8-10 years, and people just get worn out.
So worn out in the sense mm-hmm. that they're not raising concerns yep. anymore, and it's the attitude is it's going mm-hmm. to be what it's going to be?
Yeah.
Okay, well, we certainly don't want to see that, but at the same time, you've had, it sounds like, a positive experience with
Hess. Haven't with other companies. Okay. Now, we've dealt with Hess since the 1950s, my family, so at times there's been some disagreements, but of late it's been very good. And I think it's a lot better nowadays than it was years ago. For sure it is. I mean, I can show you the horror stuff that we have. But to say right now we're seeing all this new infrastructure, you either see the problem immediately mm-hmm. or you need to talk to my grandkids about the problems, because that's when they come, is down the road. And that's what I'm dealing with, is what happened back in my father or grandfather's time. And that's why these easements, and I know you guys don't deal with them, but your decision is going to affect us. And I think 90% of those people that signed an easement on this don't even know what's going on without being notified. They probably looked at that and didn't in the paper and didn't even, just went right by it. Mm-hmm. And to tell you the truth, I did see it in the paper, but we get a notice as being on a township board, so I knew about it before it came out in the paper. Mm-hmm. But the way that we, as personal, our family, regulates to get rid of the problems we had years ago is by these easements. We have whatever you want to call it. It's a renewal is what they're calling it. Every 10, 15, or 20 years, depending on what you can negotiate, that they have to come back and renew that and pay you again. Because that is how you make them take care of the equipment and the pipelines. If they got to come back in 20 years, they're going to make an economic decision that it's not worth paying him that amount of money again, or should we put in a new line? Should we abandon that so we don't have the problems? And I feel that's how you, not in bonding, but that's a whole different animal, but that is how you make sure that you don't have the problems we had years ago.
Yep. No, excellent point. It's good to know.
I would like to say I know they have applied for 100,000, but that was kind of how I was trying to make the point. As we know, there's a whole lot more oil going to be coming in the future. Now, does that balance out with declining wells to new wells or whatever? Are they going to come back a year or two and say, well, now we need, and I don't know, I'm not how much they can push through that pipe. That is not my field of expertise, but are they going to come back and say, now we want 150 or we want 200,000 barrels? You know, this changing of this, I understand the economics and I think it's good. Actually, I think it'll be better pushing it south than going under the lake. And economically, I think it'd be great for them and for the county and for everybody. But I think there's some things there that need to be looked at when you start changing what was original with these easements and what people thought. They based those decisions on this, and now you've changed it.
Okay, and then just to touch on one other thing that you brought up, and that is related to local control. And I will just say as much as I personally do not like an extensive amount of federal oversight, and maybe I don't even like that much in general, it's a fair fight, and the same holds true in terms of, you know, we have to be cognizant of what we're doing at the state level and how it impacts counties and down to local townships, because everything moves down the line, if you will. But we're also tasked with following the rule of law. And it doesn't mean, you know, I can only speak personally, I always like everything that's contained within in the law. Maybe I would do it differently myself, but as a regulator, our mission, our task is to make sure we are abiding by the rule of law, and we do have to follow those procedures as we go through cases like this. But really, really do appreciate your comments very much so. Thank you.
Mr. Chrisman.
I think my colleagues have covered most things, but I do want to say, Don, Commissioner Fedorchak mentioned the 100,000 barrels of expected volume. In this application, the maximum throughput is 160,000 barrels per day. So if you felt that violates an easement of some sort, that's up to you to explore. But I'm not giving you a copy because I've got mine all marked up and for leading into this hearing. But this is on record in our office, and it's available to you. If you feel that's a violation, here would be your evidence, I guess. And so that is something that is available to you. I do have one question, though. You mentioned something about residences that you thought were awful close. You heard the company lay out that there were originally six. One turned out to be a farm shed, so that left five. And for us, we consider those of concern to be 500 feet or closer. Did you think that we are missing some possibly, or does your township have some rule, like I said, we call them avoidance areas, that would go farther, that there are some that farther and because of local ordinances need to receive waivers?
No, I just, I said, like, you know, you have, say, 500 feet. Well, I know there's none within that, but they might be, and I don't have those figures. I mean, I could get them. Maybe they're 1,500 feet. Well, if you have something happen, that's still pretty close if you're the one living there.
Yeah, but there's no particular township ordinances or anything. Okay, thank you.
I just want to thank you all for the commissioners and all the participants to allow this public comment. And that I just would like to end with is why I have seen these happening before where I never came to them because where they were changing from what the original was. And I just think it needs to get out in the public. I've been thinking about it, but I didn't come until it affected me personally. And I'm sure there's other people didn't think about it and should be or have thought about it and didn't come. And that's why I'm here today, is to bring those questions up. And hopefully it might give you guys some questions you need to ask me. And if you need anything from our township, I didn't bring anything, but I got records. And there isn't a whole lot, like I said, because we don't do the pipelines. We just do the facilities and the roads. And
okay, thank you very much. Any other follow-up for Mr. Nelson?
No, Your Honor.
No, Your Honor.
It's fine. Misters. Okay, thank you very much. Okay. Hey, any other public input? I said at the beginning I'd give people an opportunity. I don't have anybody else that indicated that on the sign-in sheet, but if you do, please raise your hand right now. Okay, seeing none. Mr. Mann, where should we go from here?
I don't have anything further other than I don't know if you want to do it on the record with respect to.
Yeah, I think what we'll do, let's go off the record with the three attorneys for 5 minutes or so and work on late filed exhibits. We'll let the other people use the restroom or whatever, and then we'll come back and close the
hearing.
Sure.
Okay.
Thank you. That way, you stick with us, too. You're going to read out the late filed we have?
I can do that. Yeah, we'll wait and see how it goes.
Yeah.
But we did clear them so far. Okay, back on the record, it is approximately, let's see, 1 p.m. Mr. Mann, you indicated you have another witness you want to call.
I do, Your Honor. If I could call one additional witness, Brent Lonas.
Mr. Lonas, were you in the room when I gave the perjury admonition earlier?
Yes, I was.
Okay. Could you raise your right hand, please? You promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
I do.
Okay. And I want to ask you just to spell, is it Brent, B-R-E-N-T?
B-R-E-N-T.
And how do you spell Lohnes?
L-O-H-N-E-S.
All right. Mr. Mann, go ahead.
Brent, what's your position with Hess?
I'm the general manager for the North Dakota operations.
And, Brent, you have familiarity with this project?
Yeah, I do, both through operations previous to my GM role as the director of operations and prior to that, the manager of operations for North Dakota.
Sure, and you've been in the room. You're aware of the testimony that's been provided to this point?
Yes.
I just wanted to follow up on three main areas with you. One, there's been some discussion about inspections that may have been done on the existing line. Do you have any follow-up or additional information?
Yeah, I do. So there's four sections of line, really, that have been inspected. So the first one goes from the Hawkeye Oil facility to the Midway valve set. It was installed in 2014. It was hydro-tested at that time. We did not do an ILI because, obviously, it's new pipe. But the next ILI, or the ILI, is scheduled for October 30th, 2019. So that's 5 years after the installation date. so that's what that's set up in our inspection database. So that will be pulled up and scheduled at that time. The next section of line is from the Midway valve set to the B.B. Olson facility. It was installed in 2015. It was hydro-tested. No ILI was done at that time because it's obviously new line, but the inspection on that, the inline inspection, would be due October 7th of 2020 is when that is scheduled. The next section was from the B.B. Olson to the Levang valve set. Again, that was installed in 2017, hydro-tested. No inline inspection was done. But it is scheduled for August 3rd, 2022. And then from the Crestwood Aero Terminal to ETP, that's the Johnson's Corner facility, installed in 2017. We did do an ILI on that run on September 6th of 2017. The next ILI is scheduled for September 6th of 2022, 5 years after that.
Sure. And, Brent, you heard Dale's testimony with respect to monitoring. Could you maybe elaborate and follow up on what Hess's intentions are with respect to monitoring?
Yeah, sure. You know, some of the difficulty I think we've had in answering that is we're still in progress. The project is moving pretty quickly. So a lot of this is still kind of getting worked out. But the intention is, and the basis of design for the system is to have a SCADA system monitored at our Tioga office complex. We have a control room there that monitors our pipeline systems. So we'd have monitoring there with temperature, pressure, and flow. That would allow us to have a mass balance type of leak detection that Dell was talking to earlier. We have 47 lacs that enter the pipeline, so balancing all those lacs is difficult, so we have to develop an algorithm within the SCADA system that's going to do that mass balance for us and automate it. In terms of being able to tell you that it's going to reduce our response time from 24 hours, notionally, I think we can reduce that response time, but I can't give you an exact time until we kind of go through the design of the leak detection system. Another point too is what Dell was alluding to is it's very difficult with gathering systems because of the line slack, because of multi-phase flow that we get. Traditional leak detection systems are difficult at best to make reliable. So. Continuing to work through that.
Sure. And then Dale had also mentioned Hess's participation with the EERC on that project. Did you have anything to add on that?
Yeah, Dale is kind of involved in it from the outskirts, if you will. I've been intimately involved with it. We've participated with the EERC on a couple different studies coming out of the last legislative session. I can't remember what order number it is, but it was basically to investigate leak detection systems that are applied currently and then do a risk or evaluate the risk assessment model for gathering systems. We've actively participated with the EERC on those, for both the leak detection surveys and analysis and kind of their study on that, as well as with how to do risk assessments. We shared our risk assessment model with the EERC and how you could apply it to gathering systems. That report, I think, is just kind of coming out now. It may be out by now. We did review it last week, at least initially. We have some final review to do on that. In addition to that, we've formed, along with five other operators, we've formed a consortium, if you will. It's industry-led, looking at, we're calling it near commercially ready technology that is out there that could be applied to gathering systems. Like I said, we have five other operators that are joining the consortium. We hope to meet with the Oil and Gas Research Council, get matching funds, solicit matching funds from them, and then have a couple demonstrations of new technology within this year. And then we're planning basically a four-year program that will go, each year we'll select a couple new technologies to evaluate and test. EERC is really involved, really, because they're good at research and design. Operators aren't particularly good at that, so I think it's a good match between the academic side and being able to practically apply a new technology. So we're actively involved in that. We're meeting on that here in the next couple weeks again and trying to move that process forward.
Sure. I have no further questions.
Mr. Armstrong, questions for Mr. Lonas?
I don't have any questions.
Mr. Fons?
No questions. Thank you.
Mr. Fedorchak?
Thank you, Brent, for being here. Appreciate it a lot, and I appreciate you stepping forward with some insights and additional clarification on the company's plans, in particular on the monitoring side of things. A couple questions I have for you. First of all, are there pressure limits on gathering systems?
Yeah, based on the allowable working pressure for the pipeline.
Okay.
What they are for this line,
their maximum operating pressure for the line. So usually those don't change when it gets converted to a transmission system.
No, they don't.
So the system could have theoretically been pushing through 100,000 barrels per day already.
Not
if you had put the pumps on right away.
Yeah, not without the pumps. I believe, and Jody can probably correct me here, but I believe currently we are able to push about, I'm going to say round numbers, 25,000 barrels a day through the pipeline without additional pumping.
Are there
adding?
Okay. Under North Dakota law, can you put pumps on a gathering system?
Not on a gathering system. I believe once you do that, it would then cause that line to be regulated if you add pressure to it, short of coming off the well pad with a LAC.
Mm-hmm.
LACs are included in that.
So it's the pumps or storage, not both. So if you were to add pumps. Okay. So I guess where I'm leading is, do you have concerns with these conversions from a safety standpoint of gathering systems that have so many on-ramps into a transmission system that has extra pressure and can put a lot more product through it? It's just so much harder to monitor.
Yeah, so it's a great point. There are concerns, obviously, but the way you get around those with all the on-ramps is segmenting the pipelines so you can do your balances, if you will, your mass balance on a certain segment of a line. That design needs to happen yet. We haven't done that yet, but that's how you get around that, isn't
mm-hmm.
it, your system, your leak detection system.
And is that where you think the ERC study is leading towards a best practice, that type of a recommendation?
It could lead to something like that. What we are focusing on really is focused on gathering systems. In particular, gathering systems typically are not equipped or designed like a regulated pipeline, both in size and configuration.
Mm-hmm.
So the technologies that we are looking at are focused on those pipelines that you may not be able to run a smart pig down, or it may not be economic to apply a system like an Atmos system, as an example. Technologies that can help industry get around those kind of barriers, because a lot of our stuff is very remote. Ours not necessarily available where you need it. So we need to look for some innovative ways to do this.
Do you think the industry is going to adopt that sort of segmentation on its own? We don't. So in the future, when we're converting these lines from gathering to transmission, is that going to become sort of the best management, that the industry is just going to adopt that type of a monitoring system because it pays off and makes the most sense?
I think my personal opinion is naturally it's going to migrate that direction as regulations get a little more stringent, and the sensitivity around leaks gets heightened, right? And that's why industry is looking at alternative ways to monitor for leaks and maybe even mitigate some leaks, and get early detection of them on non-traditional gathering mm-hmm. pipelines.
So do you think PHMSA will be the one triggering more regulations to require that?
I couldn't say what regulatory body would do it. I guess my hope is that if industry takes a step forward, we're not going to need additional regulation.
Mm-hmm.
To do it.
That's my hope, too.
Yeah.
All right. I think that concludes my questions. Thanks again for stepping forward.
Commissioner Crocious.
Well, thank you, Brent. Can you just clarify for me, and I think I've heard the answer, but rather than repeating it in the event I'm wrong, is it that the technology doesn't exist, or is it that it isn't commercially viable at this point in time when it comes to leak detection?
So technology does exist. It's limited by a couple different things. One is location. You need to have, and by location I mean having the proper infrastructure in place, communication infrastructure in place such that leak detection systems like the Atmos system will work. So you need to have fiber optic communication basically between your start and your end points of the pipeline for those types of systems to work, and fiber optic is not necessarily available on all of our gathering lines. We have about, I think from Len Helms is one presentation he gave, there's about 30,000 miles gathering line in the state already in the ground, and hardly any of that has communication like a fiber optic system. Radio and that type of infrastructure typically is not fast enough to give the right communication that the Atmos system may need to give accurate leak detection. So that's there's technology limits based on where you can apply it. There's also the issues around multi-phase flow. That's very, very difficult to measure. If you have a gas or entrained in the product, that can skew your measurement as well. So very difficult to apply, especially in gathering systems.
Nanochip technology. No, you are. Nanochip technology, too costly, not
So that is actually on one of the technologies that we want to test and evaluate with through the ERC consortium.
Okay.
There's also another technology that is a neutrally buoyant golf ball, for the lack of a better word, that would float down the pipeline, down the center of the pipeline, using one acoustics to sense a leak. What I am told is that they can actually measure the wall loss or the wall thickness of pipe, including maybe some non-metallic pipes, which is typically what is limited. So there's some really neat technology out there. It's emerging. It's not commercially available yet, and that's what the consortium is trying to initiate is getting that technology across the line and providing that platform for them to launch. So.
And on an unrelated note, are you aware of, it sounds like you're familiar with the existing infrastructure and the timeline, are you aware of any pending or ongoing landowner issues in terms of the initial placement of any of the facility?
I'm not aware of any issues that are pending or outstanding on these lines.
Okay. All right. All right, thank you very much.
I have a question on this Atmos system. Is that an acronym, or is that a trade name, or what
is
it?
It's a company name.
And how do you spell it?
ATMOS.
Okay. Chairman Chrisman, any questions for Mr. Lonis?
Are you aware of easements being based upon throughput?
No, I'm not. I'm not saying that it's not possible, but I'm not aware that the easement included throughput through the pipeline. It is something I think we need to take away and do some research on what the language is.
And then I'm really glad you came up, because during the last break I noticed something that I didn't get clarified well enough for myself. From Mr. Foss's testimony, I understood that the pipeline from the Hawkeye facility going north across the lake is still there and still is operational. However, in the application on page 2, it says that, in referencing the purpose of this conversion, is due to unforeseen difficulties in obtaining the necessary permanent permits for the existing pipelines. So pipeline exists and is operational, so what permit did you want further in the original plan to go north with the oil that didn't exist, and what would have changed?
Yeah, so the language in that case is a bit confusing. We do have all the necessary permits for the pipeline. Through the State Water Commission, we have a requirement as part of their sovereign land permit, is limited to 5 years. And within that 5 years from, I think that was signed in, I won't give you a date because I don't exactly remember, but we had a 5-year window to enact a project to find an alternative means to cross the reservoir that would operate safely, I think, at 18, reservoir level of 1817, I think, is what it was, the minimum pool level. We'll just say that, at the minimum pool level that the pipeline needed to operate safely on that. So what that means is if the reservoir were dry and you had a riverine condition, you potentially could have that pipeline be in jeopardy due to the riverine condition. So we currently have a project now that is working to evaluate other means of crossing the reservoir with that pipeline. We have a 5-year window to do that.
And
I don't know if that answered your question.
So this is beneficial in that it moves it a different direction, and if that doesn't pan out or you're unable to get the right permits after the end of that 5-year time frame, you have a good long-term
that is
export
the oil. That is certainly an option, although we do want to maintain the ability to cross either north to south or south to north.
Sure.
Based on just kind of the economics and the market conditions. A few years back, we were trying to push 140,000 barrels a day through our rail terminal because we had a very nice price differential on rail to the plus side. Today, that's kind of evaporated with market conditions. So the advantage now is on pipeline. We have a pretty good differential on pipeline, so we're trying to shift it that way. I think eventually, as oil prices improve, there's going to be more and more drilling. We're going to need to find alternative routes for oil to be exported, as well as NGLs and gas. And rail is obviously going to be one of those that we use when we hit our peak production here in 2022-ish time frame.
Thank you.
Andy, anything else?
Oh, I'm done. Thank you.
Okay. Follow-up questions for Mr. Lonis, Mr. Mann?
Your Honor.
Mr. Armstrong?
Your Honor.
Mr. Fahn?
Thank you.
Commissioners? Okay. Thanks, Mr. Lonis.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
It. Mr. Mann?
I have nothing further.
Mr. Armstrong?
Nothing further.
Okay. Off the record, we did go over late-filed exhibits. This is essentially what we came up with. We have 12 pre-marked stipulated exhibits. Late-file exhibit 13 will be the maximum throughput capacity of the pipe. Late-file exhibit 14 will be the depth of cover of the pipe in the original construction. Late-file 15 will be a sound analysis at the booster pumps to the nearest sound receptors or resonances. Late-file exhibit 16 is the cost of the booster projects. Number 17 is filing of outstanding executed waivers and clarifying the Crestwood, whether that covers both. Then late file exhibit 18 would be potential SCADA control system. We just did some testimony about that, but I think we want some follow-up on that. And then late file exhibit 19 is the company's spill history. Anything else or not?
On the throughput of the pipe, it's for each pipe size?
For each pipe size, 10-inch and 16-inch.
Judge, on the spill history, we've typically done 10-year spill history. That's feasible.
Okay. And then with that, I'll ask for any closing remarks for the record from counsel, Mr. Mann?
No remarks, Your Honor.
Mr. Armstrong?
None.
Okay. Commissioners, closing comments? We'll start with Commissioner Fedorchak.
Well, thanks, everybody. We got through a lot of information today. Appreciate the company bringing forward a lot of different witnesses to get at the questions that we needed to have answered. I think that we've, you know, come a long way, even just in the last little while regarding the operational issues. our charge is to provide a permit that makes for minimal impact for the location, construction, and operation of this infrastructure. And so we want to make sure we have a good record covering all of those issues, and we'll move forward with the decision as quickly as possible. So thank you very much.
Mr. Crocius.
Well, thank you, everyone, for being here. I think it started to pull together for me a little bit better toward the end in terms of some past history, and I had alluded to that earlier in my comments. Just I felt as we had started this morning that there were so many questions that I had, and not just to assume that everything was the way it should be because it's already in the ground. And I think we that advanced in a good way for me as we talked. I still have some questions. You know, no one's aware, for example, of any issues with remediating or remediating something that might be tied to a landowner concern with the existing line. And the answer wasn't no, there simply aren't any. It was no, not that I'm aware of. And you know, a particular individuals who said that could very well not be aware if they're not the ones directly working with that. So I think just for future reference, to have a little bit better starting point for me personally would be helpful, and I'll be following up on those things. And then I think the monitoring aspect of the line obviously is a significant. Well, I want to make sure it's not a concern, and just to have a better sense of where that's at. So we'll continue to, or I should say, I'll continue to look at that. I always have to be careful. This isn't with three different commissioners. You have three separate votes, three separate opinions. So I can't be too liberal with the word we, which I just was. So backtrack on that a little bit. But these projects, at the end of the day, have a definite benefit to both the public and industry. They afford the opportunity to take trucks off the roads overall. Sometimes it can shift and actually increase truck traffic to a particular point. But overall, it does take trucks off the roads, and that's good from a public safety standpoint. It's good in terms of economics. We're not looking at as many or as low a price point for crude. It's certainly improved versus even a year ago, year and a half ago. So, but economics are always important because we want a stable, healthy industry in the western part of the state. That's good for the communities that are here in the oil patch in the Williston Basin. So I think that's it for me, but thank you, everyone. Appreciate it.
Chairman Chrisman, final comments.
I'll just say, Your Honor, that not a lot of public testimony that's not associated with the company today or with the county, but while we seek that public testimony because it helps us make good decisions and gives us good information, sometimes something can be learned from a lack of public concern, too. And so I guess that's something that I always like to try and remember. But Mr. Nelson did mention some concerns that maybe a lot of people don't realize what's going on here. So I appreciate that the press is here today and reporting on this and helping people to get a better understanding of the important work that this commission does. And so that probably enhances the amount of attention people are paying to what we do and increases public participation. Public participation in the future. So, thank you.
Council, can we have late filed exhibits and proposed findings and conclusions by the 24th, 2 weeks from today?
I think we'll be able to pull together all the documents by then. I think that'll be sufficient, Your Honor.
Okay. So, we'll set April 24th for late filed exhibits and proposed findings. That being said, I'm going to close the hearing now at about 1:28 p.m. Central Time in case number PU 18-24,
The hearing is adjourned, subject to the filing of late filed exhibits. Thank you all very much. Have a great rest of the day. Enjoy the sun before the next storm comes.